Daniel, we just heard a lot of words from Big Cass. He ended it by saying that you will never survive in a big man's world. What's your reaction to that?
See, Big Cass thinks he's just a big deal because he's big. Because he's big. Because he's big. Because he's big. Shin bone to the dome when your mama ain't home. Big Cass, guess what? Shin bone to the dome when your mama ain't home. You don't even know how. Guess what? I've got a message for Big Cass. Shin bone to the dome when your mama ain't home. Big Cass, guess what? Shin bone to the dome when your mama ain't home. You haven't trained hard enough. You haven't been in the gym hard enough. You don't know how to wrestle. Do you know what's gonna happen at Money in the Bank? Shin bone to the dome when your mama ain't home. And you can't teach that.
It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
My client!
Mama Monster!
Conquered the street!
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
He's fat, delete.
You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Shin bone to the dome when your mama ain't home. Daniel Bryan in 2018, everyone. As soon as he said that, as soon as I heard him say that in that promo, I immediately set out to find myself a beat, and I went to work. Actually, I had no intro for today's show. I put the whole thing together about half an hour ago. So all things considered, I think it turned out pretty well. Welcome to episode 550 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, June 10th, 2018. I am the Solid Monster. Thank you, everybody, for downloading, streaming, listening to this podcast. Very much appreciated. 550 episodes deep. It's pretty cool as we approach, in a few months really, in November, is the 11-year anniversary of the very first episode of The Sound Off. So that's a pretty good run right there. Speaking of runs, there was another great run that came to an end this weekend. We got so much to get into here. Obviously, we're going to talk about CM Punk. Quite a bit of CM Punk stuff to get into from last night and really this entire week. And the New Japan Dominion show, which I saw most of. I'm going to have a review of that here in a few minutes. And a bunch of other things as well. For those of you who have been asking still about my leg, the leg update is this. The leg is healing. It's doing well, all things considered. I'm still kind of hobbling around a little bit, but I no longer have to carry my pimp cane around with me, which is good. Had I needed it a little bit longer, I was ready to bedazzle it. I was going to start decorating it, maybe, I don't know, strap some feathers to it or something, or maybe some tassels, and now I don't have to do that. I do have an appointment, though. This week, I'm going to get a second opinion from a different orthopedist, this one at the Hospital for Special Surgery. So if I bump into The Undertaker while I'm there, I'll try to get an interview. But anyway, so I'll keep you guys posted on that. But thank you for everybody who's been asking. I'll tell you what I'm excited about this week, and it ain't Wednesday when I go see the orthopedist. It's Thursday, because Thursday night at Madison Square Garden, I will be attending my very first ever Hall & Oates concert. You guys know my fondness for Hall & Oates. They are the best band. Do not debate me on this. And for all their songs that I like and all the years I've been listening to their stuff, I've never actually seen them perform live. I've never been to a Hall & Oates concert. And I found out a few months ago they were coming to the Garden, so I made sure I got tickets. And apparently Train, I think, is either performing with them or opening for them. And I know a few of their songs. I really don't give a crap about Train. I don't even like taking the train. So it's all about Hall & Oates, and I'm very excited. I'm more excited for this than I am Money in the Bank. So that's on Thursday night. Maybe I'll do like a little mini review on the podcast next weekend. I don't really know what to expect. All I know is that I still see those YouTube videos that Daryl Hall does. I think it's this restaurant that he has somewhere, and maybe it's at the restaurant in the basement. He calls it like Daryl's House. And he just has these sort of, you know, unplugged recordings, and he'll bring in the occasional musician and some names that you would know like musicians from other groups, and they'll perform Hall & Oates songs with him, you know, and they'll provide the vocals, and some of them are really badass. I mean, they do a hell of a job with it. Hall is just, you know, he's having a blast. He's just having fun. And it's pretty cool. I suspect that the concerts are probably similar, and we'll find out. We'll find out on Thursday. Audible is still offering listeners of this podcast a free 30-day trial of their service, and with that trial, you get one free audio book. A lot of you cashed in more than usual this past week, cashed in and got your free book. I think some people took my advice and picked up the Bob Holly book, The Hardcore Truth, which is one of the best wrestling books I've ever read. And it's up there with the Jericho books and the Mick Foley's first book. I think Jericho's second book is also available on Audible. Some of Foley's books are as well, a bunch of others. So if you cancel your trial, you know the deal. If it's not for you and you just don't want to continue on after the 30 days, you can cancel before the 30 days hits and you still get to keep your free book. So I don't know what you're waiting for. Get on it right now, audibletrial.com/Solomon. So you got to go through the sign-up process, and then you can cash in on your free wrestling book. Thank you to everybody who made a PayPal donation this week. TheSolomonster.com is the place to go. Right-hand side of the page, you'll see the PayPal button. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname and a shout-out here on the show. John Luzcani Lopez, thank you, buddy. Deadpool James Herrera, thanks to him as well. The Florida Freebird, Brian Becerra. Yvonne Bruiser Balak. Hot Stuff, Hector Pena. Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray. The Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard. The Malaysian Mastermind, Samuel T. Aim for the Head, Andrew Jorlog. The Show-Off, Corey Van Dam. Luck is for Losers, Lance Flint. Flyboy, Jazvani Rollins. The Anarchist, Andrew Heller. The Dirty from the 530, Gabriel Sanchez. The Brooklyn Bombers, Jamel and Isaiah Walker. Shout out to Isaiah, who is celebrating his 20th birthday this weekend. Raymond, the Mountie Medina. The Renton Road Warrior, Taylor Schatt, who agrees with me from last week that pancakes are better than waffles. And I do like waffles. Don't get me wrong. I used to have waffles. I used to buy the Eggo waffles. Lego my Eggo, right? I like waffles, but you know what the problem is with a waffle? I'll tell you right now. Here's the problem with a waffle. It's not a pancake. So there you go. Poison Pill, Lindsay Manns, Villainous Havoc, Courtney Summers, Dalvin the Crazy Cruiserweight Brown, who just celebrated his birthday on June the 5th, so happy belated birthday to Dalvin, who I've met before several times, in fact, here at Five Borough Wrestling independent shows in Brooklyn. And last but not least, Badman Barry Furtado, who wanted to use his donation here to give a shout-out to somebody who deserves the attention. She is a young lady named Lau. I hope I'm pronouncing that right, but that's how it's spelled, L-A-U. And her Twitter, you can find her, I guess her name, maybe Lau is short for Laura, but her Twitter handle is at Laura Mareroo. That's M-A-R-R-E-R-O-O. Her YouTube channel is XGamerGX. And the reason I mention this is because she put a video together covering her experience living through Hurricane Maria. And it's very well done. I watched, not the whole thing, I watched a good part of it, though. It's very well done. It's very scary. And anybody who's been through any sort of experience like that, I mean, I'm sure if you were in Puerto Rico last year, several months ago, whatever it was, but I'm terrible with time. But anybody who lived through the horrors that went on in Puerto Rico all those months ago, and probably is in some parts anyway, still going through it, you know how scary those storms can be in the aftermath of those storms. The power goes out, the winds, the destruction, the death, all of that kind of stuff. So anyway, she documented her experience going through the hurricane, and the video's up on her YouTube channel. Again, her username on there is XGamerGX, and you could check that video out. It's tough to watch, but, you know, it's again, something I think everybody should at least check out for a few minutes and be aware of, because this is really happening, and it really knocks you for a loop when you get hit by a storm like that. And now we're in the midst, I think, hurricane season just started, I think, if I'm not mistaken. And so it just feels like we're getting more and more of these things, right? You're hearing about other places getting more and more violent storms, and it's pretty scary stuff. So anyway, check out her video. Lucha Underground. A lot of you have been asking me, how come you haven't mentioned Lucha Underground? Because I've been waiting. I've been waiting for this week. Because now we're only a few days away. Lucha Underground, you thought I forgot. I wouldn't forget. What, are you out of your mind? Of course I'm aware. Lucha Underground is back this Wednesday, June 13th, Season 4. Only 22 episodes this season. Normally in the past, they've been closer to 40. So this is a shorter season. In a brand new temple, they had to move out of Boyle Heights, I think due to costs. And they moved into an old ice house in downtown L.A. Literally a warehouse where they store ice. So that is where the new temple is. There is no Prince Puma this season. He's a little bit busy elsewhere these days. No Rey Mysterio. But otherwise, I think most of the core cast, anyway, is back. Pentagon is obviously back as the Lucha Underground champion, the way we left things off last season. The trailer for the new season, when it dropped last month, I watched it. I thought it looked pretty sick. From what I can remember about the trailer, I watched it a couple of times after it first came out. And I remember I spotted Johnny Mundo in there dressed up, I think, as Indiana Jones with Taya. Taya had this giant katana sword on her back, so I have no idea what that was about. King Cuerno is back. He missed most of last season until the finale. Katrina, of course. My dear Katrina, cannot forget her. And I think there were actually clips in the trailer. There was a fight scene backstage with her, and I want to say Melissa Santos that looked kind of interesting. Most importantly, though, Dario Cueto. Dario Cueto was in the trailer. Now, he was shot at the end of last season. He was all bloodied, just left for dead. He was in the trailer, but in the trailer, he had long white hair. He had a beard. He had sunglasses. So either he aged 30 years after being shot, or he's a fugitive. Maybe he had to change up his look. I don't know. Hopefully it's not some kind of flash forward or flashback scene. He better not be dead. That's all I gotta say. He better not be dead. But I've seen glimpses of the new temple. They had some clips in there, and I'll wait and see how it comes across on Wednesday. I'm not a fan of the brighter colors per se. I kind of like the dark, gritty, grungy, dingy look of the old temple. I don't know how much of that this new building retains. Hopefully this one isn't done up too nicely, right? You don't want it to be too nice. But I'm just happy the show is back. I mean, I know some people were not enamored with the last season. They thought it really fell off, or they just don't like the show. They don't get the show at all. They don't just understand it. It's not their thing. I liked the last season well enough, maybe not as much as the other seasons, but I liked it. I still enjoy the show. And for me, it's a welcome change from the, you know, some of the recent garbage that we've been spoon-fed on Monday nights. So the Lucha Underground reviews will be back, starting with episode 551 next week. That's still on my bucket list of things to do, by the way, as far as like a wrestling fan goes. I'd love to be at the temple, you know, whatever the new one looks like. I'd love to get there one day. I was invited a few months ago. I just couldn't do it. But I'd love to one day have the chance to go and see a live taping of Lucha Underground. I think that'd be a lot of fun. CM Punk earned a big victory this week. That victory, however, was not inside the octagon. Last night at UFC 225, Punk lost badly to Mike Jackson, another 0-1 fighter, much like himself, who beat the shit out of him in three rounds in Punk's hometown of Chicago to hopefully put an end to his MMA career once and for all. And I say that with no malice. Punk is just not cut out for this fighting thing. He's just not. Dana White even said after the show that Punk should call it a wrap on his UFC career. Should call it a wrap. You're the president of the UFC. If I were, he could put his foot down right now and say, this guy ain't fighting ever again. He shouldn't leave the decision to Punk, unless he's got like a contract or something, and he's got a fight that he has to honor or something. And if so, I would put him on the lowest of low cards. But for God's sakes, call it a wrap. You should be the one to put your foot down and say, call it a wrap. And Dana said he regretted not putting that fight on Fight Pass as opposed to the main card. No shit. That fight had no business being on the main card. I know what they were going for. They think Punk is an attraction, they think, and it's Chicago, and you know, their pay-per-views aren't doing as well as they used to do, so I get it, but again, that fight had no business being on that card. What happened last night was an embarrassment. If you are a fight fan, if you are a hardcore MMA fan, if you are a UFC fan, okay, and I look, when it comes to MMA and UFC, I've said on the show before, yeah, I'm a casual fan. I don't hate it. I like it. You know, some of the fights are very exciting. Some of them are just not exciting at all. I don't know all the names of the fighters. I don't follow it along that closely, but yeah, I'm a casual fan. I got no issues with it. But if you are a diehard MMA fan, I don't see how you could watch that and feel anything other than embarrassment and disgust for the sport. And if you're a wrestling fan and a CM Punk fan, I don't see how you could be anything but happy about the outcome, because now, hey, you may well get to see Punk come back to wrestling. I don't think he is. I think he's really just fed up with the whole wrestling thing, and he's probably done, but at least for a while. I mean, never say never. But if you're a wrestling fan or a Punk fan, you should be delighted that hopefully he's gotten this out of his system, and hey, maybe now he'll come on back home, because I'm not sure what else there is for him to do other than, you know, write comics and make passionate love to AJ. Which, when you think about it, writing comics and making love to AJ doesn't sound like such a terrible life to live. But one still has to make a living. So let the CM Punk all-in rumors intensify, because, of course, that's all we're going to hear about the next 3 months. Punk came out to Cult of Personality, got a really great hometown response, right? He did an interview with Ariel Helwani before the fight, and he said, look, I don't know how people are going to react. I would hope and think they would react well. I'm a hometown boy, but, you know, maybe they'll shit all over me. You know, maybe they'll still see me as the wrestler who doesn't belong here, and they'll boo me out of the building. But they did not. They cheered him. They had loud CM Punk chants. It felt like transported back to Money in the Bank 2011 there for a few seconds. He looked happy, coming off his big legal victory this week, which I'll get to in a second. Mickey Gall made short work of him in his first fight. That was almost 2 years ago. This was a fresh start for him. He's had 2 years to train, two more years to improve and get better. I don't know what he was doing for those 2 years now that this fight is over after having watched it, but he had 2 years to get better. But again, the guy is 39 years old and he's been beat up, right? I mean, he's been beat up going back to well before he even got to WWE. Head injury, all kinds of injuries. Plus, he's new to the sport, so it was going to be an uphill battle for him no matter what. I thought his best round was the first round, which is low praise. I mean, by the end of it, he looked gassed, like he was going to collapse. He kept throwing these kicks and twirling his body. Like, I've seen fighters throw kicks like that before, but they kind of stay stationary in one position. They rotate their leg, but their body stays, you know, in one position. But he would throw these kicks and he would twirl his entire body around. It's like he couldn't help himself. You know, maybe he could be a ballerina. Cue all the ballerina photoshops. Let's go. Come on. Come on, internet. Don't disappoint me. But he did get one takedown in the round, at least. Joe Rogan, it was almost like I could hear Joe Rogan giving him a golf clap for it on commentary. But after that, I mean, it was all Mike Jackson. I mean, you could have put Michael Jackson in there with him and it wouldn't have made a difference. And I mean Michael Jackson now. Get his corpse in there, and I'm still not sure Punk would have done any better. It probably still would have been a 10-9 round for Michael Jackson. But he had Punk down on the mat in the later rounds. He was playing with, I don't know what he was doing. This other guy didn't look all that good either. He had him down. He was waving his arms around. He was looking at somebody out of the cage. I have no idea who he was looking at. I guess his coaches, I would presume. Maybe he felt bad for Punk. You know, he wasn't looking at the referee asking him to call the fight. He was looking at somebody else like he didn't know what to do. He could have finished him off. He didn't. So this guy is almost no better than Punk. You know, maybe he saw a hot girl in the crowd. I don't know. But he was toying with him. It was so bad. Joe Rogan is on commentary, and it got so bad and so uncomfortable watching this that you have Joe Rogan, okay, one of the UFC announcers. And I think he was joking, but honestly only half joking. He's on commentary talking about the fact that, hey, somebody must have paid off Mike Jackson to not finish CM Punk and let the fight go the distance. Which it did. It went the full 3 rounds. Punk survived all 3 rounds. I say survived, barely, but he survived all 3 rounds. It went to the judges. They awarded it by unanimous decision, 30-26. to Jackson. Punk's face was just a bloody mess. He didn't give any post-fight interviews. He left the octagon. Ariel Helwani reported that Punk was taken to a hospital for a facial CT scan. And by the way, did nobody clue him in that it's a local medical facility? It's not a hospital. So Helwani came back on Twitter a few hours later. He reported Punk suffered no injuries. They evaluated him. He suffered no injuries and they released him. Punk took to Twitter to tell his fans. He said, "You win some, you lose some. I'm one for one this week and I'll take it. Thanks to my team, my family, my friends, and the fans. Wouldn't be here without any of you. Respect to @TheTruthJackson. Thanks for the fight. You only live once, and I'm alive." I said this on Twitter last night. I respect CM Punk for hanging in there and for putting in the work, and he wanted to try something new, and he went for it, right? A lot of people probably in their minds are like, man, I'd love to try this one day, or man, what would it be like to switch careers and do this? And they don't do it because they're too afraid. Or whatever their reasons may be. Maybe they have a family, you can't take the chance. Punk said, look, you know, I'm done with this wrestling thing. I'm going to try my hand at MMA. Yeah, I'm almost 40, but whatever. I'm going to try this MMA thing. And it didn't work. But hey, I respect him for at least trying his hand, if nothing else. He's got more balls than most people for even getting into the cage. It takes a special kind of person to go in there and get punched in the face, knowing you're going to get punched in the face, which he had to know was going to happen. So I'll give him my respect for that. But I'm not going to sit here and I'm not going to pretend this was some sort of big victory, especially for wrestling fans. Like, I saw some people online saying, oh, this was a win for wrestling fans. CM Punk hung in there toe-to-toe with an MMA fighter. He didn't get finished. This was an embarrassment for wrestling fans. Are you kidding me? The pro wrestler went in there and he got the shit kicked out of him. So quit pretending like this is some kind of moral victory, you know, for wrestling fans. You weren't in there fighting. If Punk was a stock and you invested all of your money in him, you'd be broke right now. I mean, UFC, I thought UFC is supposed to be the elite, right? The biggest MMA promotion in the world. Guys train half their lives to be good enough to get onto a UFC pay-per-view and get a payday. This guy got two fights out of it. He shouldn't have had one, but he got two. Hopefully that's his last. That doesn't mean he won't want to fight again. He hasn't said anything about whether or not he still has aspirations of fighting, or, you know, it doesn't mean that a Bellator or some kind of promotion like that won't come in and offer him a deal for some kind of freak show fight. But whether it's his wife, whether it's Cabana, whether it's his coaches or whoever, somebody has got to step in here and just tell this guy, look, you tried, but this fighting thing, it just isn't for you. You're good at the fake fighting stuff, and you could probably make, not even probably, you can make a lot more money at that too. But I mean, I'm watching this and by the second round, I'm feeling guilty watching this. I felt like Duke in Rocky IV screaming, throw the damn towel. You know, when your announcers are openly discussing conspiracy theories about, you know, fighters being paid off and saying that the referee should stop the fight, which they also did, that's a bad night. You can spin it any way you want to. That's a bad night. So respect for the effort. But that does not mean that I have to stand up here and applaud what I saw last night. He's not some washed-up fighter. He's not like a Chuck Liddell or somebody, you know, 40-some-odd years old who fought their whole life at the end of their rope, flailing around trying to land one last shot. He's a civilian at fantasy baseball camp who thinks he could run the bases, and then he gets a Charlie horse sliding into second base and has to be carried off the field. That's CM Punk. Enough. That was embarrassing to watch. Not as embarrassing as Raw most weeks, but embarrassing nonetheless. By the way, they also aired a great video package last night announcing Ronda Rousey as the headline attraction, the headline inductee this year for the UFC Hall of Fame, July 5th in Las Vegas, which may explain why Rousey was given a Raw Women's Championship match so quickly. Because it was very weird, right? When they did the whole Ronda Rousey, Nia Jax thing, Ronda hasn't even had a singles match yet. All of a sudden, mid-June, Money in the Bank, she's getting a title shot. Kind of makes you scratch your head. It really does feel like they found out something and they changed whatever their plans may have been, because it's not just that Ronda is getting a championship match so quickly. It's the fact that they were going one way with, and this might explain the storyline inconsistency with the Nia Jax character, because after she beat Alexa Bliss, she did that promo with Backlash. She was sort of the anti-bullying figure on television in WWE. I talked about this last week. And now, in less than 4 weeks, she's gone back to being this heel bully. So none of this really made any sense, and now they make this announcement, and all of a sudden it makes sense, right? It makes sense. They probably want that title on her before she goes into the Hall of Fame next month. So, especially if she walks out of Money in the Bank with the championship, there's your answer. Now, Punk did get a big win in the court case with the WWE doctor, Dr. Amon, or Dr. Amon. I say Amon because I think that's the correct pronunciation, but who gives a shit? The jury deliberated only about, I think they only deliberated for a couple of hours before they returned their verdict in favor of CM Punk and Colt Cabana, meaning they owe the doctor nothing. He gets no damages, but he's also not responsible, for those who have asked, for paying the legal costs for Punk and Cabana, their legal fees. Punk and Cabana would have to file their own suits against the doctor to try to recoup the costs, and there's no guarantee of that, so they're still out thousands of dollars. You know, Colt Cabana, I feel mostly happy for him because he really got dragged into this mess. He had no business being sued or dragged into this. He did nothing wrong. You know, he was the one who really got screwed over in all this, and he's still out thousands of dollars. Again, unless he wants to file his own suit, which will cost money. So I don't know if he's interested in doing that, but their long legal nightmare is finally over. It's a big win for podcasters everywhere, too, because had the jury found in favor of the doctor, it would have potentially had a very chilling effect on anybody with a show of their own. Punk, of course, has since been asked numerous times, okay, does this mean you're coming back? Does this mean you're coming back to wrestling? Does it mean you're all in this September in Chicago? He said no. He said he is done with professional wrestling. Now, this was before he had his face caved in last night, so his opinion, his view may have changed since then. He may have just been saying that because, look, I'm still a UFC fighter, I'm going into this fight, no, I'm done, leave me alone. Again, his perspective may change real quick, but this is what he was saying as of a few days ago. Now, he is still scheduled to be doing a signing at the Pro Wrestling Tee Store in Chicago the same weekend of All In. He is friendly with one of the Young Bucks. I think he'll make an appearance at the All-In show. I mean, it's impossible to know what's going on in the guy's head right now other than, I'm sure he probably is concussed, but there may be some brain matter floating around in there, but I think he'll be there. I think it would be very weird for him to be right there in Chicago, do a signing like this. You gotta know wrestling fans are gonna be coming up to you the whole day, right? Just asking you and heaping praise upon you. You've got some friends who are, you know, putting the show together. And in his mind, you know, look, if he's got a vengeful bone in his body, and he probably does, you know, I'm sure WWE, he has to know that WWE is probably looking at this. And not that they're scared, but, you know, this is a big endeavor here. There's a big, you know, independent wrestling show, independently financed wrestling show. 10,000 people in a big building in Chicago, and, you know, maybe if he wants to stick it to WWE, he'll pop up on the show and start doing things, you know, I don't know. Again, it's impossible to know what's going through the guy's head right now, but if he has the MMA stuff out of his system, he may be more open to a wrestling return. But that, again, is just my thought, my prediction that he will be, maybe not wrestling, but that he will make some sort of appearance at the All-In show, but only he knows what he wants to do. There's always ballerina. He could always be a ballerina. Now, I do have to mention the Corey Graves tweets. Corey Graves wins for the saddest of sad tweets this week. He had a hissy fit after Punk lost his fight. He tweeted the following. He tweeted a lot more than this, but I'm going to read these initial four tweets that he posted last night, right after Punk lost. He said, maybe abandoning everybody who stood by your side even when we weren't supposed to, only to have you turn your back on us, wasn't the right move after all. No anger, only sadness. And then he said, aw, it seems the fans are disappointed. Maybe you guys should know that that dude held my son, my first son, before I did, because I was on tour and I trusted him. I had dinner with him the week after he quit. He said, the first rule of, quote, punk rock is loyalty, and this guy betrayed it all. I still love you, friend, and I'm sorry you got lost. And then he said, don't worry, hey, at Vince McMahon. He tagged Vince McMahon and Triple H in this tweet. Hey, Vince McMahon, this has nothing to do with you. You either, Triple H. This isn't corporate, this is real life. Calm down, inter-nerds. Wow. Inter-nerds. Very original. I wonder if he came up with that on his own. Or if he had someone in his ear telling him to say that as well. I don't want to rag on Graves too much, because I still think he's a good commentator. He's more of a breath of fresh air than a lot of others they've put in that spot before. Usually by now I've soured. Like even when JBL came back in 2012 or whatever it was, if you go back and listen to the old sound offs, I don't shy away from it. I was a big fan of JBL's commentary when he initially came back and was paired off again with Michael Cole, because it was different. He had gone away for a while, he came back, I liked the sort of the chemistry that he and Cole seemed to have. And then, again, it was probably Vince's vision of what the commentary should be. Maybe he had Vince in his ear. I mean, we've heard Mick Foley talk about having Vince in his ear. That's why Foley didn't last very long on commentary. Whatever it was, JBL turned to absolute shit. And nobody celebrated more than I did when he was, you know, he wasn't kicked off, but when he left the commentary booth, you know, I mean, nobody was happier than I was, because he was insufferable towards the end. It tends to happen with a lot of these people. I'm not yet sick and tired of listening to Corey Graves, and he's been doing this for a while now, so that's a good sign. I generally like his commentary. And it seems like he is genuinely hurt by what he perceives to be his friend abandoning him. I'm sure it's a very shitty feeling. He gave an interview to Fightful.com to explain his tweets. This all happened last night, so you gotta, you know, the Punk Fight opened the pay-per-view, I believe, right? So that was after 10 p.m. Between the hours of 10 p.m. and like 4 or 5 a.m. is when all of this happened. So he tweeted all this stuff, and then he gave the interview to Fightful. And in the interview to Fightful, he said that he and Punk were basically thick as thieves. They had a friendship going back, you know, a decade. And then right before CM Punk's first UFC fight, he texted Punk about meeting up for dinner, because I guess WWE was in Chicago. So he texted Punk about meeting up for dinner, and he claims that Punk texted back saying he no longer had any interest in being friends with him or anybody related to WWE. He said, part of me just thought he was in a zone, and I didn't take offense. I texted him the day of his first fight, something along the lines of, I know life is nuts, I still love you, good luck. And he never heard from Punk again after that. He claims that he's texted Punk no less than a dozen times since then, and nothing. Radio silence. He said, what really set me off was this week when he essentially disowned the business that made him. My only issue with him was that he turned off people that actually loved and supported him beyond the business, and he never wanted anything to do with us, and yet he continued to present himself as this punk hero. I'm simply hurt and pissed off that a guy I looked up to as a big brother has turned his back on me and everybody that loved and supported him only because of the name on my paycheck. I'm definitely not the only one. I won't name names. But there is a large group of us to this day that inexplicably lost a solid friend because of where we work. So there's a lot to unpack there, and I believe him. I have no reason to doubt that he's lying or making any of that up. Chris Jericho has talked about the fact that, you know, since Punk left the company, he had tried texting him, and I believe Punk blew him off. I wonder if Kofi Kingston maybe is part of this group that Graves is alluding to, because I know Punk and Kingston were tight when he was still in WWE. And actually, the rumor, which was never, I don't think, confirmed, unless Cabana confirmed it and talked about it on his podcast at some point, which I don't think he did, but there was always that story that Colt Cabana and CM Punk had a falling out within the last couple of years that was centered around Punk finding out that Cabana apparently was backstage, I guess, visit. I don't know if he probably wasn't invited, but supposedly Cabana was backstage at either a live event or a Raw taping or something, just visiting with friends at a WWE show. And this was, I think, after Dr. Amon had already filed, Dr. Amon, I did it again, had filed that lawsuit. So while all of this is going on, supposedly Cabana was backstage at a WWE show, and Punk allegedly felt betrayed by this. Now again, that was never confirmed, but you hear what Corey Graves is saying here, and it would certainly lend more credence to the idea that Punk is somebody who, once he feels that you've crossed him or that you've betrayed him in some way, you're dead to him. He doesn't come across as like a big softy. He comes across as a hard ass, and it's not really all that difficult to believe that what Graves is saying is true and that the Cabana story is true. And even Hornswoggle. Hornswoggle has told the story. You know, he used to be friends with Punk, had his phone number, and I don't recall offhand exactly what it was, if he... it might have been a mutual friend of theirs, possibly from WWE. Maybe not a WWE person, but a mutual friend. He lost the person's number, and I think he may have texted Punk asking for the person's number because he lost it, and Punk turned on him. Punk just basically killed their friendship over the whole thing because he felt as though he was using him for something, and Punk, I think, stopped talking to him at that point. That's insanity. So, you know, there's other stories of this out there that actually paint the picture of CM Punk as being quite the gigantic asshole. And I don't doubt for a second that CM Punk probably is a giant asshole. But the thing with Graves, though, this whole thing, it's just a bad look. You know, it's a bad look, and I'm not talking about his tattoos. It's a bad look for Corey Graves to take this to the internet, to air out your dirty laundry. And a few minutes after this guy just had his face smashed in on live TV, he completely comes across as a jilted ex-lover. He sounds obsessed with CM Punk. He was up tweeting until 4 a.m, saying he'll fight him. He will fight CM Punk. Somebody tweeted at him and said, oh, Punk could beat you in a fight. And of course, that triggered Graves. And he was like, oh, you think so? I'll fight him. I'll fight CM Punk. Now, is he talking about a real fight? Or is he talking about a WWE match? Who can be sure? This is, after all, the same man who once bragged about how he fooled the internet into believing that he had a real beef, a real-life beef with Booker T. I didn't see Booker on Twitter calling the fans dweebs and nerds. Only Corey Graves. Now we're supposed to believe, oh, this is real life, he says. Now we're supposed to believe him now. If you're so salty that your friends stop returning your calls and stop responding to your texts, guess what? It's because he doesn't like you anymore. And judging by some of those tweets last night, I can see why. New Japan Pro Wrestling had its annual Dominion show this weekend, one of the bigger shows of the year that it hosts. I watched most of it yesterday. I missed the first two matches. I picked up with the tag match with Ishii and Toriano against Minoru Suzuki and Zack Sabre Jr. Overall, another great show. Really liked what I saw, really enjoyed it for as long of a show as it was. It kind of breezed by for me. In that tag team match, Sabre tapped out Yano to pick up the win. So just some random notes here going through these matches. I'm not going to go too deep into, you know, everything that happened, but the thing that struck me about this match, what was cool, is before the finish, Sabre had a very unique counter to the low blow from Toriano. And I hope AJ Styles was watching this as he prepares for his match with the Nutcracker next Sunday. Yano went for a low blow, and Sabre clenched his legs together to trap his arm. And then he submitted him. So that was different. I thought that was cool. Then after the match, post-match, a big brawl broke out between Ishii and Suzuki. Each man, they're, you know, just going at it. They both grabbed the chair. They got back into the ring. Now we have a standoff. They both have chairs like lightsabers, and they swing them at each other. And then they slap the piss out of each other outside. People tried to break them up. Suzuki ran to the back. I say run. I mean, the guy's, you know, his knees aren't what they used to be, but he ran to the back. And I was very upset the cameras did not follow them back there. Some say they may still be fighting, for all we know. But that was pretty cool stuff. I mean, Suzuki is, when I watch New Japan, Suzuki, like many of you, I'm sure, besides the fact that he terrifies me, is one of the more fun acts on the show. I'm not even sure it's an act. I say acts like, you know, he goes backstage and he's, you know, dancing with kids and painting rainbows on the walls. I don't think he is. If he is painting rainbows on the walls, he's probably painting it with people's blood. The never open weight title match, champion Hirooki Goto against Michael Elgin and Tai Chi in a three-way. I don't much care for Michael Elgin, to be perfectly honest with you, so I didn't really care about the match. I didn't really get into it. I know Elgin won the championship with the Elgin Bomb, and that's really all I have to say about that. The Young Bucks beat Evil and Sonata to win the IWGP Heavyweight Tag Team titles for the very first time. 7 times they held the Junior Heavyweight Tag Team titles, but never the heavyweight, never the main tag team titles. They won with more bang for your buck. Really good match. I think it was Nick. The blonde one. Yeah, it was Nick. Nick was selling the hell out of his foot and his ankle. He kicked the ring post at one point, and for the remainder of the match, just was selling the hell out of the foot. Really, all the way, even after the match, all the way to the back. So it wasn't just, again, the Young Bucks still get a lot of flag. Oh, Beth flips and all these things. And I don't know, some of the Young Bucks match I've seen recently, including the one here at Dominion, it's not just about flips. It's such a hollow argument for people to use on these guys at this point. It's just an excuse. They just can't bring themselves to call these guys good professional wrestlers. So they use that as an excuse, all the flippy moves, and they break kayfabe, and it's just all the reasons they don't like the Young Bucks, when in reality, they just cannot bring themselves to admit that these two just so happen to be two really good pro wrestlers. So this was really good stuff and some good psychology there. Cody, Hangman Page, and Marty Scurll against Hiroshi Tanahashi, Jushin Thunder Liger, and making his New Japan Pro Wrestling in-ring debut, which is hard to believe after the career that this man has had. But in his debut, Rey Mysterio Jr., whose name they misspelled in the on-screen graphic. Oops. So it was a win for Bullet Club. Mysterio, though, looked good. I'm happy for him. I really am. I'm happy for Rey Mysterio. He was bitten by the injury bug for a while there with those knees. But it seems like he's been able to stay pretty healthy with the schedule that he's made for himself, where he's not wrestling night in, night out. He's been able to stay pretty healthy overall since leaving WWE. It's funny how that works. You leave WWE and all of a sudden you're healthier. You're healthier. You're happier. He looked great. Also, I thought in Lucha Underground, he looked great in his appearance in the Royal Rumble this year, and this was no different. There was a top rope Hurricanrana from Liger to Cody, but Cody ended up pinning Liger after hitting the crossroads. We had Hiromu Takahashi challenging Will Ospreay for the IWGP Junior Heavyweight title. This match was insane. More moves than I can even describe here, so I won't even try. But you know what was even more insane? I will describe this. This was the butterfly pile driver from Takahashi. I've seen this a couple of times, but this was just, this is a sick, evil looking maneuver that probably, realistically, it's probably safer than like most people giving a normal pile driver. But the way he does it and the way they shot it and the way it looks, man, I don't know that I would ever put myself in a position to take a move like that. It's a sick looking move. It looks great. After that, he hit the time bomb and he won the championship. And then we get to the what they build as the double main event. Tetsuya Naito defending the IWGP Intercontinental title against 9-time WWE Intercontinental Champion Chris Jericho, who was searching for his 10th IC title between WWE and New Japan. Jericho came out dressed like something out of, I guess one of the announcers mentioned, A Clockwork Orange, which I guess makes sense. Only he had terrible makeup on. Naito came out, and before Naito could even get to the ring and take off his vest and his shirt and his pants and all of his gear, Jericho jumped him. And for like the next 10 minutes, the bell hadn't even rung. The match had not even officially started yet. But for a good 10 minutes, Jericho just beat the crap out of Naito outside the ring. He was flipping over tables like a madman. He powerbombed Naito through one of those tables. And these are the Japanese tables. These are not these flimsy piece of crap American tables that if you blow on it, it breaks. So to take a powerbomb and break through, and this thing just exploded. It looked great. So he put him through a table. He gave Naito a pile driver onto one of the announce tables at ringside. This Bruiser Brody Jericho is actually a genius idea because this guy could wrestle like this for the next 10, 15 years if he wants to, right? He doesn't have to do moonsault. I mean, he still does the lion's salt, but he doesn't have to do fancy maneuvers and dives, which Jericho, I don't remember Jericho in the last 5 or 10 years being big on doing suicide dives anyway. But he could just come out and he can have a wild brawl. And, he did that with Omega. His match with Kenny Omega started the exact same way that this one did. The guy's a wild man now. his WWE character and his New Japan character, it's funny. It's like night and day. They bring back Jericho to WWE. He's a good hand to have. He was in the Royal Rumble, right? Or the Greatest Royal Rumble, whichever one it was. And I think it was the Royal Rumble. And you know, he could be in there for 30, 40 minutes. He could come back as a babyface. He can come back as a heel. He's a very versatile performer in that way. I wrote a column once for JBL's website many years ago. And it was all about Kane. And it was talking about how versatile a performer Kane is. And he may be the most versatile in the history of the company. And that you could take him. And he's not some mid-card act. Kane's a big name, but you can plug him almost into any situation. You want him to be the monster heel? He could be the monster heel. You want him to be the comedy babyface? He can be the comedy babyface. He's been corporate Kane. He could fill any role. Jericho is very much the same way. He's very useful in that way. I could see why they keep bringing him back, because besides the fact that he's a big name, he could pretty much do anything you want him to do. And the fans will follow along with it. So the point is, WWE Jericho, though, typically, like, the last few times he's gone back, you know, it's just, not that he's sort of coasting, although maybe he is in a way, but, you know, whatever. It's just, oh, Jericho's back. Okay, you know, and he's here to fill a role. Compare that to his New Japan character, heel Jericho, wild man Jericho in New Japan. It's like night and day. Like, WWE Jericho is like his LinkedIn photo. New Japan Jericho is like, you know, Snapchat photo, like, you know, delete this shit after 10 seconds. Like, that's the Jericho I like to see. So for all the people who were like, oh, this sucked, Jericho was slow, he was botching things, he looked terrible, he had dad bod, all these different things. It's like, I don't know what match you were watching as far as like it being a bad match. I thought this match was really good. It was not as good as the Omega match. The match at Wrestle Kingdom was better. But this was a damn good match. Naito's eye was all bloody from the assault. Naito just sold forever. Finally, he made a comeback. He ripped his clothes off. Jericho's lost a step. I don't know if it's just age. I don't know if it's, the shape he's in physically, which he's still, you know, look, it's hard. What is Jericho now? 46? 47? Something like that? You know, and he's on tour doing his music stuff. I doubt that Jericho's hitting the gym every day. He's on some kind of strict, workout protocol or anything like that. He doesn't look like the Jericho of old. And Jericho was never a bodybuilder. But yes, he does not look like the Jericho of old. He actually looks like a guy who is 46 years old, right? But he's still a hell of an athlete. He can still go in there and hit all of his signature spots and not make a complete embarrassment of himself like some guys might at that age. But he's lost a step. The only real botch, it came from the first Destino attempt. When Naito went for the Destino, Jericho couldn't get him all the way around. There was a little bit of maybe a miscommunication on it, and it looked bad. I think Jericho turned it into a pin attempt. And then after that, there were a few rocky moments where it looked like they weren't on the same page. Once they got back on track, like I said, I thought they had a really good match. It was weird to hear the fans booing Naito for a good part of it. They did finally, you know, they were cheering him too, but they were booing Naito for a good part of this match and cheering for Jericho. And Jericho is doing every heel thing you could possibly do to get people to hate you, right? Besides beating up the babyface, he's flipping the fans off and doing all sorts of stuff. And I don't know, it was weird because I don't usually expect that from a New Japan crowd. That's something I would totally expect from a WWE crowd. I hope that some of that American bullshit is not seeping into the Japanese product. Some of those elements are better kept, I think, outside of Japan. But even Kevin Kelly, you know, even he kind of sounded surprised by the reaction. I don't think they were expecting that. But Naito went for the Destino. Jericho escaped. He shoved Red Shoes. Okay, so he shoves the referee. Now, with the referee briefly distracted, he lifts his leg from behind, gives Naito, rather, a low blow. He pulled a Nakamura on Naito and gave him a low blow. And then he hit the Codebreaker, which looked great. It was a great sell from Naito. And he got the win, which surprised the hell out of me, because I didn't think they were going to do the title change. I just figured, you know, Jericho's schedule is such that, you know, I don't know how many matches he can commit to. You're really going to put a championship on him? I didn't think they would do it, but they did. And Chris Jericho is now the IWGP Intercontinental Champion, the 10th IC title of his career. He attacked Naito after the bell. He started whipping him with his other belt, his leather belt, until Evil hit the ring to make the save. So the way that all went down and Jericho left the ring, he grabbed Don Callis's headset. He's like, who are you? Who is this guy? Like, he was eyeballing Evil. It made it look like that could be the next match for the championship. I'm thinking they do the rematch. If it were me, I would set up the Naito rematch at their G1 special. They got a big G1 special here in this country coming up on July 7th at the Cow Palace in San Francisco. Last I heard, they were having some trouble, I think, moving some tickets. So, to me, one of the bigger matches you could have on that show probably would be Jericho defending in a rematch against Naito. I think of the two, you know, Naito or Evil, I think the Naito match is the more marquee one. Not the main event of that show, but I think of all the opponents that Jericho could have, that's the one that makes the most sense. And then it was time. It was time for Okada Omega 4 for the IWGP heavyweight title. No time limit, best 2 out of 3 falls. The same Kenny Omega this week who was referred to on WWE.com as independent wrestling star, Kenny Omega. He does have a New Japan contract, for the record. He's technically not independent. Not that this is a big deal. I just thought it was funny. At least they didn't say that he... what was it they did that time with... Was it AJ or Bobby Roode? One of them came to... Maybe it was Joe. One of the TNA guys came to WWE. And on .com, they're just like, you know... he spent like the last several years of his career traveling the circuit down in Florida. It's like they just... Even in a .com story, they couldn't bring themselves to mention TNA. You know, or impacted, but they're just so inconsistent with it because on their own network, like those Table for Three specials, they'll openly talk about TNA. It's just it's the inconsistency that kills me. They did a whole write-up, though, on WWE.com this week because Xavier Woods and Kenny Omega are going to be playing Street Fighter, I think this Thursday, is it? Sometime this week in the Capcom booth at E3. I know E3 is a very big deal to a lot of people. So that's happening this week. Anyway, Okada took the first fall. Went about half an hour before we finally had that first fall decided. Omega ducked the Rainmaker, went for a sunset flip, but Okada dropped down, hooked his legs forward for the pin. Very much the Bulldog Bret Hart finish from their SummerSlam match at Wembley. So that put Omega in quite the hole, having to score 2 straight falls over a man who has held the championship for 2 years. And is rarely pinned. I think even in tag team matches, rarely is Okada the one to eat the pin. Okada had the biggest shit-eating grin on his face, like he knew he had this thing in the bag. They had 2-minute rest periods between falls. So he's just standing there, staring at Omega, big smile on his face. They did a lot of little things like that in this match, whether it was the selling of certain injuries or facial expressions. Later in the match, when both of them were you know, exhausted, the way they were just sort of stumbling around. Like, they told a great story in this match. It wasn't just a bunch of moves. It was just really good, like, throughout the entire thing. So, in that first fall, Omega was knocked off the apron onto the guardrail outside. And he hurt his ribs. He was selling the ribs. That was part of the story for the remainder of the match. Omega was fighting through busted, possibly broken ribs. Omega did take the second fall with the one-winged angel for the pin. They made it a point to mention that Okada has never kicked out of that move before, the few times that he's been hit with it. So Omega got the second fall, which we all knew. Third fall, both guys are spent. They are completely exhausted. They look like CM Punk did. Only Punk looked that way after about 3 minutes last night. These guys were almost 60 minutes in by this point. Okada shot Omega into the ropes at one point, and Omega just collapsed. Right? Because if you got a guy who's completely spent, you're not going to whip him, Irish whip him into the ropes, and he's not going to run at full force, right? Omega's just selling the fact that he's got nothing left. These guys are throwing forearms, knife-edge chops, punches, slaps, all sorts of things. They have no power behind them. It's just, you know, it feels like a war, right? These guys have been through a war. Omega hit a Styles Clash for a near fall at a different point in the match. That led to an AJ Styles chant in the crowd. And Kevin Kelly pointed out that it was, I think, 3 years ago at Dominion that AJ lost the championship to Okada. That was a great match. You want to see a great finish to a match? That's one of the best finishes to a pro wrestling match I've ever seen, was that final little sequence between Okada and Styles with the crowd just completely amped up. Go back and at least go back and try to find a clip of the finish, because that was awesome. So there was a lot of stuff here. Really, you just need to watch the match if you haven't seen it from start to finish. I know some people don't like the longer matches. This is a very long match, but it's well worth your time. Omega hit a wicked V-trigger. One more one-winged angel right in the middle of the ring and got the pin to become the new champion. That last V-trigger and the camera shot of it. So Okada's sitting, and he's sort of leaning on like the middle rope. The camera is perfectly positioned. You see Omega come in. He got a second win. He came in full force, and oh my God, did he obliterate Okada with this knee. The most devastating knee that I've ever seen since mine went through that window a few weeks ago. He fucking obliterated him with that knee. And then from there, the crowd knew. The crowd knew what was coming. Kevin Kelly knew what was coming. It was building and building and building. He hit that one-winged angel, and it was just the perfect finish. And finally, after all the wars, after all the waiting, Kenny Omega is the IWGP champion, and so ends the 2-year reign of Okada. One of the all-time great title runs in wrestling history. Yeah, it wasn't Bruno for 8 years, but you look at just the guy's body of work, the matches, the quality of the matches that this guy had. You know, wrestling is a work. Anybody could be champion. I mean, it is kind of weird sometimes to talk about it like it's real. Like, oh, he was champion for a year. This guy's a Hall of Famer. Look at the body of work. You could be champion for, look at Brock Lesnar. Brock Lesnar has been champion for over a year. And if he drops the belt at SummerSlam, it'll be, a year and a half? 18 months, something like that, as champion, which sounds great. But when you look at the guy's body of work in those 18 months, it's a lot less impressive. And Brock's had some good matches since he came back. Not so much in the last year. You know, in part because he's not around a whole lot, but he's had some real stinkers too. Look at the body of work that Okada has had as champion. Look at the matches that they put this guy in there. 25, 30, 35, 40 minutes, an hour. He can go with Kenny Omega. He can go with anybody, really. But, you know, I've seen him have the matches with Omega. There was a great match. I don't know if it was the G1 or when it was. That he had with Evil, I think it was last summer. He had that match with Cody at the first U.S. special, the G1 special last year, which I didn't think was as great as some people said it was, but that was still a very good match. There was a match, I think, with Okada and Sonata that I remember watching that was really, really good. And, you know, Sonata is sort of this star on the rise that they see. And so you could put the guy in there with almost anybody, and he's going to have a great match. And you just look at that body of work. This guy is the best in the world right now. I believe that. As a performer, as a pro wrestler, from a match quality standpoint, there is nobody better in the world right now than Okada. The Young Bucks came to the ring after the match. They hugged Omega. Kota Ibushi was in Omega's corner for the match, which I meant to mention that earlier. So he was out there. He joined in the group hug. Omega cut a promo first in Japanese, then in English. Cody walked halfway down the ring, or the ramp rather, and then he changed his mind, turned around and went to the back. He's had his issues with Omega, obviously. The match itself, one of the best matches I've ever seen. I love how they bring the crowd up, and then they bring them down, up, down, up, down, like a roller coaster. I don't want to start comparing it to the other three. It's impossible. I can't sit here and say which one. I can't rank them. I can't say which one was the best. I love them all. I love that entire series of matches. I've never seen these two have a bad match. I've never seen these two have a good match. I've only seen them have very good to great. This match was basically three matches in one, you know, with the stipulation. But those were great matches, and so was this. You know, but for a 65-minute match, I'll say this much. I was never bored. They did scare the crap out of me when Don Callis mentioned Kota Ibushi outside having the white towel. And I thought Don Callis was great, too. Callis, he tried, right? In kayfabe, he tried to hide the fact that he is good friends with Kenny Omega and he was rooting for Omega, but it came through a few times during the match where he was openly rooting for him, and he saw Kota with the white towel, and he's just going like, wait a minute, what the hell is this guy doing? Because he was worried. He got me worried because I suddenly had visions of Owen Hart at Survivor Series 94 with the towel. Now, I didn't think they would do it, because boy, would that have been a crappy way to end this match. But part of me wasn't entirely sure that they wouldn't have Kota as his friend throw the towel in and maybe use that as a way to kind of build to an Omega-Ibushi match, like Ibushi cost him the championship. I was hoping they wouldn't do that. They didn't. What they should have done is probably should have flown Ibushi to Chicago after the show. He could throw the towel into the octagon for that Punk fight. That's what he should have done. But it just felt like the right time to do the title change. I know a lot of people felt the right time was at Wrestle Kingdom against Naito. Maybe, you know, for Naito's sake, yeah. Maybe for Naito that was the best time, but I like that it was Omega. I would have done it at Wrestle Kingdom next year. I think when I did my whole prediction show in January, that was, I think, the prediction I made, you know, pending the, you know, whether or not Omega signs a new contract, I figured next year's Wrestle Kingdom, they're gonna build to it, they're gonna let Okada go another year with the title, and that's where they'll do the change. And instead they did it at Dominion, but I think it was inevitable that that belt was gonna find its way to Omega. So I like the fact that it was him who took the title. It ties up their story nicely. And now it opens up a whole bunch of possibilities, because you look at what happened at the end of the show where Cody came out, they seem to be teasing or wanting you to think that maybe Omega and Cody is the direction they're gonna go in. Maybe it's Omega against Cody for the championship on July 7th at the Cow Palace show. Omega versus Ibushi, I think, is something that is probably also inevitable, but I would save that for Wrestle Kingdom. To me, that's a Wrestle Kingdom worthy match. I certainly wouldn't do that anytime soon. One last note, the top two champions in New Japan are from Winnipeg. And I know Jericho wasn't born in Winnipeg, but that's where he grew up for a good part of his childhood. He moved there as a kid. Kenny Omega was born there. So you got two Canadians on top of the New Japan Pro Wrestling pyramid right now. Actually, if you look at all of the top champions in New Japan, none of them are Japanese. Kenny Omega, Chris Jericho, the Young Bucks, Michael Elgin is the never open weight champion, Jay White is the U.S. champion. And those, I guess those would be considered the top titles, I guess. I know Hiromu has the, is it the junior heavyweight championship? But if we're looking at top champions in this promotion, it's all non-Japanese wrestlers. And it just so happens that they have a big U.S. show coming up in less than a month. So I doubt that's a coincidence. Monday Night Raw was live from Houston, Texas. How the hell do I go now from Dominion to Monday Night Raw? How can I do this? It's not fair. Twitter poll, 2,700 votes, 19% thumbs up, 81% thumbs down. As you can probably tell from those lopsided numbers, a lot of you did not like this show. And that makes at least one thing that you and I have in common. This show was terrible. From an entertainment standpoint, this was a terrible show. Speaking of terrible, we are getting Roman Reigns versus Jinder Mahal on Raw tomorrow night, 6 days before Money in the Bank, and I would guess, again, at Money in the Bank. So I don't know this, but I would suspect that the fact that they're having a match tomorrow night does not mean that we are not getting the match at the pay-per-view. And maybe it ends up being an angle and they don't have a full-blown match tomorrow night. We'll see, but they decided people were so excited for the match that they had to give it to us 6 days early. If their match tomorrow is anything like their interaction in the opening tag team match from this show here last week, I will pray for a power outage. Elias and Jinder beat Reigns and Rollins in that match, with Elias pinning Seth after a DDT onto a chair, followed by Drift Away. The referee was staring right at the DDT on this chair and did not call for the DQ. So I don't know what does he think this is New Japan or something? I don't know what the referee was thinking. We had Curt Hawkins in the ring with a table full of tacos outside the ring. He was one loss away, he said, from 200, but he vowed to win, and when he does, he promised everybody in the building would get a free taco, and they all cheered. He wrestled a local guy who called himself James Harden. not to be confused with the Houston Rockets, James Harden. You know, the team that LeBron James will be playing for very soon. Baron Corbin came down and gave James Harden the end of days, giving him the DQ win. See, so he beat up the jobber on purpose to give Curt Hawkins another loss. Which also meant no free tacos for the fans. Because Baron Corbin ruins everything. Which is a great name for a new Fox sitcom. I hope that's part of that Fox deal. $1 billion for SmackDown and a sitcom of nothing but Baron Corbin ruining everything he comes in contact with. Speaking of Corbin, he told Kurt Angle that Stephanie McMahon had appointed him the new constable of Monday Night Raw. So basically, he's going to be to Kurt Angle what Chief Morley was to Eric Bischoff. He'll be his glorified, you know, assistant who butts heads with Kurt on different matters behind the scenes when Kurt is backstage texting on his phone. And Corbin will come in and will generally ruin everything. I noticed this week I've also been blocked on Twitter by our follically challenged constable. I must know if this also extends to Uber pickups. I would hate to think that he would refuse to pick me up in that sweet ride of his, you know, the one he was bragging about a few weeks ago on Twitter. Nia Jax beat Natalya with newly minted UFC Hall of Famer Ronda Rousey sitting in on commentary again. The announcers, this was very weird. The announcers asked Ronda before the break what she thought about Nia, or actually it was Corey Graves, who asked Nia, or asked Ronda, what do you think about Nia saying that you're ripe for the picking? And Ronda responded by saying only her husband calls her that. And then they cut to commercial. Now that was awkward enough. You would think, okay, just drop it, move on. But oh no, they come back, and Corey Cronkite over here, he just would not let the question go. He asks again, he goes, oh, before the commercial, before we were rudely interrupted here, I wanted to know, Ronda, what you thought about Nia calling you ripe for the picking. And Ronda Rousey, without missing a beat, and they put the camera on her, just completely deadpan, no expression, no life in her face or anything, just says the exact same line about how only her husband can call her that. And with that, Michael Cole simply moved on. Now, if Graves was a real journalist, like, you know, Bobby Heenan was, he would have followed up on that and asked her what the hell she meant. Natty tweaked her knee, or she was, acting like she tweaked her knee before Nia beat her. Ronda came down to the ring to check on her friend. Nia seemed genuinely concerned about what she had done, and is Natty okay? And even backstage later on, there was no indication that Nia was being insincere in her concern for Natty. Matt Hardy and Bray Wyatt did an interview in the ring with Renee Young. Remember how excited people were to see what WWE would do with Broken Matt? Remember how excited I was to see what sort of creative things Matt and WWE would come up with, creative vignettes of him doing the Woken character outside of the ring and maybe outside of the building. It didn't have to be always from the Hardy compound. It could be Matt Hardy in whatever city they're in on the street, like a man on the street type thing of him and his Woken getup. Like, there's different, I think, creative ways to utilize that character in a funny, entertaining way. And I was on this podcast wondering aloud, you know, hey, how much creative freedom would they be able to show Matt? What ideas would Matt come up with? I can't wait to see what they're going to do. I actually enjoyed the whole thing with, you know, Wyatt at the Hardy compound. I forgot what they called it already, but, you know, I like when they do stuff like that. Seems so long ago, doesn't it? It seems like a lifetime ago. And now here's Broken Matt, just another face in the crowd. Such a shame. We had the B-Team winning the Tag Team Battle Royal to earn themselves a Raw Tag Team title match at Money in the Bank. So this was a Tag Team Battle Royal where if one member of the team was eliminated, the entire team would have to go hit the showers. And so the very first team eliminated from the match, Dolph Ziggler and Drew McIntyre. Probably the best tag team act on that entire brand right now. They were the first ones eliminated. At least it was Ziggler who was eliminated. And when McIntyre found out, he sort of just flipped out, and they beat the crap out of a few people. I guess that was the idea behind it. But boy, you talk about killing a battle royal dead, killing my interest in a battle royal dead by taking those two out of it first. I mean, good for the B team. Their act is already starting to wear a little bit thin on me, but they're getting themselves a tag team title match at Money in the Bank. And really, you know, Matt and Bray have the championships. It is not out of the realm of possibility that they will do a title change at Money in the Bank. You know, I could easily see them putting the titles on Axel and Dallas. Sami Zayn made fun of Bobby Lashley's Instagram this week in the next evolution of this feud before finally calling him a liar. Sami did this from the crowd, by the way. He was literally in the crowd, deep into the crowd, holding a microphone. He was keeping his distance from Bobby Lashley, who was in the ring. And he questioned whether or not Lashley really even ever served his country. Fuck this show. Fuck this show. I don't even want to talk about the rest of it. I really don't. You know, WWE, it came out this week, is campaigning hard for an Emmy Award. Now, they're not campaigning for an Emmy Award for Raw or for SmackDown, but they're, campaigning for one for some of their WWE 24 documentaries on the network and some other specialty programming. That 24 special they did on the women, I think it was called Empowered. I actually think those 24 specials are fantastic, and it's some of the best work that, you know, production-wise that WWE does. And I think those specials... And I felt this way for a long time, even about some of the DVD documentaries that they put out years ago. I could never understand why they didn't submit, unless they did and we just, you know, weren't aware of it. But I'm not aware of them ever even, you know, trying to submit any of those old DVD documentaries to any film festivals or anything like that, because some of those are really well done. And I thought, man, how are they not getting any recognition? Even like a lower level type of award, you think they would have won something by now. It's possible they just never thought to submit those. But the 24 specials on the network, I feel the same way. They should be doing that. They should be submitting them to film festivals or for Emmy consideration. So, you know, people were kind of poking fun at WWE this week. They're going for an Emmy. Are you kidding me? Have you watched this show lately? Which is true. I agree with you. But if it is for these other programs, then I think that's exactly what they should be doing, and I think they deserve some recognition for it. You know, the production people who work on a lot of that network stuff, it's really, really good stuff, and I think it should pick up some honors along the way, because it's really well done. But as far as the rest of this show, I have no interest in talking about it. Let's move on to SmackDown. SmackDown was live from Corpus Christi, Texas, which is always very much hit or miss when they're in Corpus Christi. And speaking of Corpus Christi, it was in the news this week for a very different reason, almost as terrifying as the last few weeks of Raw. This was a story, I'm going to read this to you right now, from the local ABC affiliate down there. A Corpus Christi man was bitten by a rattlesnake after he had already beheaded the snake. Jennifer Sutcliffe and her husband were doing weekend yard work when she spotted a 4-foot rattlesnake. Sutcliffe and her husband... quickly took his shovel out. There's the shovel. And he cut off the snake's head. Moments later, he bent down to dispose of the snake, and that's when the head bit him. Holy shit. Sutcliffe called 911 and began driving her husband towards the hospital. He began having seizures, lost his vision, and began bleeding internally. She could not get to the hospital quickly enough, so she met up with an ambulance. She said the first 24 hours were the worst. Doctors told her husband might not make it, even after giving him huge amounts of anti-venom. A normal person who is going to get bit is going to get 2 to 4 doses of anti-venom, and this man needed 26 doses. He is now in stable condition, but his kidney function is still poor. The doctor said that in the event you get bitten by a snake, you should keep calm. Oh, yeah, that's real easy for him to say. Keep calm, keep the bitten area above heart level, and get to the nearest emergency room. I think we may have just figured out why all those Corpus Christi crowds have traditionally sounded like a bunch of rotting carcasses. Except for this week. This week they actually showed signs of life. They showed a pulse this week. But I think we found our answer. They've all been bitten by rattlesnakes. It's the only explanation. See, I'm a Northeast guy. I'm not a Texas guy. Although I've been to Texas. Dallas. It's very nice. But I'm a Northeast guy. I was born in the Northeast. I still live in the Northeast. And we have our own disgusting things here. Water bugs and roaches and things of that nature. Rats. But I'm not familiar with snake protocol, because snakes are not something I usually have to contend with. We don't get too many of those around here, only in Albany. That's where all the politicians are. Got plenty of snakes there. But in Brooklyn, you know, you may get the occasional garden snake. I wouldn't know, because I've not seen one, but I know they're around here. Okay, you might get a garden snake, but, you know, it's nothing I've ever come across before. I had no idea. I learned something new this week. I had no idea that if you cut off the head of a snake, you are not supposed to touch it for at least an hour. I think it's an hour, right? You people, all you Southerners out there who know this better than I do will correct me if I'm wrong. But I think they tell people to wait at least an hour before you do anything, or just maybe bury it and leave it alone or something, because if you reach down and you touch that thing, there's a pretty good chance you will get bit. That is insane. So there's your nightmare fuel for this week, at least until 8 o'clock on Monday. A Twitter poll for SmackDown, over 1,700 votes, 65% thumbs up, 35% thumbs down, so a positive overall score. Not a great score, but overall a positive score. I want to thank real quick Wade Keller of the Pro Wrestling Torch for having me back on his SmackDown post-show recap on Tuesday night. One thing I did not get to mention when I was on with Wade was Sonya Deville in that opening handicap match with Mandy Rose against Asuka. I was really impressed by what I saw from Sonya Deville. And I've talked about Mandy before, about, you know, how she really is actually not bad at all in the ring. And I've not seen a Mandy Rose match where she's embarrassing or anything like that. And I think in time, she could turn out to be a Trish Stratus type who, you know, you look at her and my God, I mean, she's great eye candy and all that. But, you know, in time, I think she could turn into a really good wrestler. But I really usually don't say anything about Sonya Deville, who's not bad, but she's never really stood out to me as compared to Mandy until this week. And those last few minutes of the handicap match that led to the finish, I thought were really, really good. That may have been the best that she's looked in the ring in all the times I've seen her. Asuka did still get the win, though, with the Asuka lock heading into her match with Carmella at Money in the Bank. Overall, this was a very uneventful show. Not bad, just did not have a whole lot going on. It did move some stories along going into Money in the Bank. The best thing on the show was the contract signing. And how often do I get to say that? That the best thing on the show was a contract signing with AJ Styles and Shinsuke Nakamura. They did this a little bit differently than usual in that they held the signing backstage, not in the front, you know, or in front of the live crowd. You could hear the crowd. They didn't mute the crowd, but they did this backstage. Paige was there. She was at the head of the table overseeing the signing. AJ was flanked on his side of the table by Dean Malenko. And Nakamura had Adam Pearce on the other side with him. What a tag team match that would be. Nakamura and Adam Pearce against AJ Styles and Dean Malenko. AJ got hot at Nakamura. He was very upset. He's just tired of his bullshit. He's tired of all the games. He's tired of all the funny faces and the no-speak English and all the low blows, and he's fed up. So he signed the contract. He demanded that Shinsuke sign the contract. Nakamura claimed that his pen had no ink, and so he could not sign the contract. He asked for AJ's pen. AJ gave it to him. Nakamura looked at it. He says, "This pen is broken," and he tossed it behind him. And AJ had to be restrained by Malenko. He said, "Okay, I'm good. I'm good. I'm okay." And then he smacked Nakamura right across the face. A fantastic slap right in the face that when this thing was over and Nakamura got up to leave, you could tell his face was all red. It was swelling a little bit. He got him good. I mean, he smacked the crap out of this guy. That slap was better than all of Monday Night Raw. So after AJ got pulled away, Nakamura pulled a pen out of his own jacket pocket. he's like the greatest troll on the roster right now. And he signed the contract. This was better than most contract signings. It was short, too, which always helps. The shorter, the better when it comes to contract signings. Becky Lynch beat Charlotte with the disarmer. They had a good match, clean winner. No interference from any of the other Money in the Bank participants. Becky needed a win like this. She's been so marginalized on this show over the last several months. But I also watched this and I thought to myself, a clean win over Charlotte here in this match? This woman doesn't stand a chance of winning at Money in the Bank. I don't think she does. Renee Young got the Mean Gene treatment interviewing Big Cass on one of the old school interview platforms. They dust these off every few years. They use them for like a week or two. And then they're never seen again. So I doubt that this thing is here to stay. But I like the backstage contract signing, like I said. Production-wise, it felt different from what they normally do. And different is good. So that's why I like this. It was also obvious the only reason they probably did this was to film Cass low with several different cameras, several different camera angles, to make him appear even taller than he really is. He looked like he was just, you know, towering over everybody. And he is a big guy, but they used to do that with Andre. Andre the Giant, they would shoot him low. When Andre would walk out to the ring, they had this great shot where the camera would be positioned low. The person behind him would have the camera low, aimed up at him. And all you saw was just this massive back. It's like blocking out the sun, you know, as he walked to the ring. Because it just made him look even more larger than life that way. Mark Henry, when Mark Henry would come out on Raw, let's say, he'd walk out as he stood there. Where would the camera be? Right behind him. And the guy almost blocked out the entire camera. So I think that was probably why they did this the way they did. And again, that's the whole point of the storyline with Daniel Bryan. He even talked about it here. I'm taller than you. I'm taller than you. He said Bryan was only a little bit taller than Renee. He said he was backstage at WrestleMania 30 when Bryan won the world title, and Bryan's win was a fluke, just like his win at Backlash over Cass was a fluke. So, as a segment, I like the way it was shot and all that, but this went on probably longer than it should have. I don't really care for the story. I think it's a weak story to tell, even though it's a basic one. I think it's just weak, poor storytelling. Now, this aired on television. Daniel Bryan's promo did not. That was a response. And so that aired on WWE.com and YouTube. And, you know, look, it may end up getting a bigger audience that way. It is a changing world. But still, it was kind of odd that Bryan did this unbelievable promo. And if they don't replay this thing on the show on Tuesday, then these people are brain dead. I don't know what else to say. This needs to be replayed on television on Tuesday. This was maybe the best promo of Daniel Bryan's life. Now, I know he had that really good one at Ring of Honor after Morishima injured his eye. That was back when he had the detached retina. But this was great stuff. You heard some of it already at the top of the podcast that I played. I would encourage you to find it and watch it in case they don't show it on Tuesday. It got me at least semi-hyped for their match at Money in the Bank, which I didn't think was possible. Shinbone to the dome when your mama ain't home. I don't know what orifice he pulled that phrase out from, but that was awesome. That was a wrestling promo. New Day beat Miz, Rusev, and Samoa Joe in the main event. Rusev and Joe turned on Miz. They walked out on him. They left him to die at the hands of Big E. This was not as good as last week's six-man with New Day against Miz, Sheamus, and Cesaro. This just felt like they tried something that worked the week before, and so they just figured, well, we'll replace the bar with Joe and Rusev. We'll just plug in two new faces and do the exact same thing, because we don't know what we're doing. We don't have any better idea. The good news is that all of these losses for The Miz only strengthens my belief and my prediction from January that he's winning the briefcase at Money in the Bank. I mean, I'll save my predictions, all my predictions for next weekend. But I can tell you that my prediction has not changed in the last 6 months. I still believe that Miz is going to win the Money in the Bank contract.
Hey, Sell the Monster Sounds Off podcast listeners. I'm Wade Keller from Pro Wrestling Torch. Maybe you've heard me on the Steve Austin Show on a regular basis, recapping pay-per-views. Well, now you can hear me four times per week. I do a post-Raw and post-SmackDown show called the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show. We have a co-host, including, on a regular basis, Jason Solomon himself. Plus, live callers, our mailbag segment, and an on-site correspondent. And then later in the week, my podcast One Shows feature the Thursday flagship and interview Friday. Check them out. Search Wade Keller in Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or anywhere that you listen to Pro Wrestling Podcasts.
WWE made an announcement this week about their UK shows coming up at the Royal Albert Hall in London. They are back in that building for the first time since 1991, June 18th and 19th. They're going to have back-to-back tapings of their United Kingdom Championship Tournament special. Night one will have the quarterfinals, semifinals, and final matches of the tournament, with the winner earning a UK Championship match against Pete Dunne on night two. So far in the tournament, Flash Morgan Webster and Jordan Devlin have advanced. They will meet in the quarterfinals, as well as we have Ashton Smith is in the quarterfinals, Travis Banks, Drew Gulak, Jack Gallagher, Joe Coffey, Dave Mastiff, along with some other names that are advancing here in this tournament. Night one also has a six-man tag team match with Pete Dunne teaming up with Tyler Bate and Trent Seven to take on the Undisputed Era, Adam Cole, Kyle O'Reilly, and Roderick Strong. The Live Nation website for tickets, which are still available for those of you who may be interested in going, is also advertising a women's fatal four-way for night one, pitting Toni Storm, who has signed a WWE UK deal. You remember Toni Storm from the Mae Young Classic last year. She was one of my favorites. I was hoping they would sign her. They did not. She may have already been under contract, maybe she just wasn't interested, but she is now under a contract to be part of the WWE UK stuff that they're doing. So we have Toni Storm in this match, as well as the Progress Women's Champion Ginny, who also, I believe, may have signed a WWE UK contract. So obviously WWE is not playing around with that ITV world of sports stuff. They're signing as many people as they can right now to keep them from going over there. Toni Storm, Ginny, Isla Dawn, who I believe is Scottish, I think is what I had read, and Killer Kelly. And the winner of that match will get a NXT Women's Championship match against, I presume, Shayna Baszler, unless Shayna loses the title to take over to Nikki Cross. But the winner of that four-way will get a women's championship match on night two. Night two, in addition to that UK title match and the women's title match, will also have a tag team title match, as well as an NXT North American championship match and another tag team match on night two. Aleister Black will team with Ricochet against Velveteen Dream and EC3. Now, I mentioned World of Sport and how they are moving ahead with the World of Sport. It's a not a pilot. I think they're moving ahead with the first, you know, batch of episodes, and we'll see how that does. And I mentioned that and had WWE signing up all these people left and right. Well, they announced this week that Johnny Saint, the legendary Johnny Saint, has been appointed as the new general manager of WWE's United Kingdom brand. And given that there is no formal brand yet, they don't even have a show yet, that could be another preemptive move, I think, to keep a legend like Johnny Saint from going anywhere else. Just kind of odd they would make the announcement now instead of waiting even just a few weeks. I know that Johnny Saint has been at the Performance Center, I think, last year. He did a guest training stint there. He is very well respected. He is a legend in British wrestling. He's a legend in wrestling, period, not just British wrestling. And he is now the new GM. Apparently, ticket sales have been slower than WWE had anticipated. It's only a 5,500, I believe, seat venue. It's not that big. They shouldn't really have that much difficulty filling it, given that you have promotions like ICW and Progress and others that have done crowds even bigger than that for some of their bigger shows. But now they're advertising appearances for night one by Shawn Michaels and Triple H. I remember that last show at Royal Albert Hall largely because Gorilla Monsoon mentioned it during the 1992 Royal Rumble match. Been a while since I've mentioned that match. I was overdue for a name drop. But if you remember, British Bulldog drew number one in the 92 Rumble, and when he came out, Monsoon was on commentary talking about him having just won the Royal Samovar Trophy only a couple of months earlier. He had won this big battle royal, and they were teasing that, hey, he might do the same thing here in the Royal Rumble. I guess he won this other battle royal, and so therefore he, you know, gives him some sort of an edge or an advantage in these types of matches, I guess is what he was trying to say. Of course, he didn't win. He was a failure. But you can now watch that entire Royal Albert Hall show from 91 on the WWE Network. It is under the Home Video Classics section. There were a whole bunch of matches, plus the Battle Royal. It's Yeah, I don't remember it being, this spectacular show or anything, but for novelty's sake, it is worth going back if you've never seen it. I think, at least back then, I hope it hasn't changed much, because I remember watching that show thinking, man, this is a really cool setting for a wrestling show. Even the aisle where they would come out and stuff, it was just so unique that I can only hope it hasn't radically changed since 1991, but it has been, over 25 years, so it's possible that it does look somewhat different than it did back then, but they had other matches on that show. LOD against Power and Glory. At least that one went longer than their WrestleMania 7 match did. The WrestleMania match went about a minute. I think somebody may have been injured. That may have been why it went so short. Undertaker against Hacksaw Jim Duggan was on the Royal Albert Hall show, which was terrible, as most Duggan matches were in WWE. You know, you hear a lot about how great Jim Duggan was in Mid-South, and his legendary feud with Ted DiBiase, and the tuxedo, what was it, like a tuxedo coal miner's glove street fight or something that they had. I wish we had gotten that Duggan in WWE and not the one that we got. But anyway, Ric Flair against Tito Santana. So this is their first time back in 20-some-odd years. Royal Albert Hall did host a Lucha Libre show, I think about 3 years ago for the first time. So yeah, there's a history of wrestling in that venue. It's like a much larger version of the Hammerstein Ballroom. That probably is the best way I can describe it. It will not be airing live on the 18th and the 19th, like that first UK tournament special did on the network. Instead, this will be available on demand a week later. So the air dates are June 25th and June 26th. And then after that, obviously, it will be on demand. Now, I mentioned Shawn Michaels appearing on night one of the UK special. Michaels was in the news this week. And by the way, if you want to hear an awesome cover version of Shawn Michaels' theme song, go to Spotify. Look up Sexy Boy by a group called It Lives, It Breathes. I just heard it for the first time the other day. It came up randomly in like a wrestling playlist. And it's really good. It is really good. But anyway, Michaels gave an interview to Sky Sports to promote the UK tournament. He was asked about an in-ring return. Now, he gets asked a lot about this. His answer has always been pretty consistent that, back in my day, I would love to wrestle XYZ, but I'm done. I'm enjoying retirement. And, he makes comments like that. And there have been reports of offers that have been made to him, supposedly over the years, for him to come back. And even if offers haven't formally been made, there have been at least three or four different opportunities, storyline-wise, where it would have been perfect for Shawn to come back for one last big match, and he never does. He just seems content to be retired, and enough time has gone by where you start thinking, hey, he may go down as one of the few big, big stars who actually retired when he wanted to and stayed retired. It's been over 8 years since that WrestleMania match with The Undertaker. He's been pitched supposedly multiple scenarios, and like I said, he hasn't bit. You had the, if you remember, they teased us with him and Daniel Bryan a few years ago when he super kicked Bryan and Bryan put him in the Yes Lock on TV. And it was like, wow, maybe they're fixing for a Daniel Bryan-Shawn Michaels match, and Shawn had a hand in training him. What a great match it would be. Never happened. You had the Photoshop poster of Michaels against AJ Styles and the rumors of that match for the Royal Rumble at the Alamo Dome, which I'm convinced was my fault because I pitched that scenario on this podcast, I think before anybody else did, and it was like right after that, there was a Facebook page, I think, that took what I said and dressed it up as, news and rumor and not opinion, which is wont to happen. It's not the first time, nor will that be the last time that somebody does that, taking something I said here and kind of putting it out there as a piece of news when it really isn't. But it happened, and all of a sudden, AJ Styles is being asked in interviews about the rumors of a match at Royal Rumble with him and Shawn Michaels. And anyway, if Shawn wanted to come back, he could have. If it was about money, then he would have done it a long time ago because there's plenty of money for him to make. Supposedly there was an offer made for the greatest Royal Rumble, a big money offer, and obviously he didn't bite on that either. So this is what happened this week, though. That's the reason I bring all of this up. What sort of changed this week was the tone of one of his answers. He was asked this question in this Sky Sports interview, and this is the answer he gave. He said, I've been retired for 8 years now, and when it got to the 5-year mark, I thought people would start asking me, but they just kind of stopped. I think it's one of those, You would never say never about things, and if it was just for a one-off, then it's something I would take a look at. Well, well, isn't that quite the change from what he has said previously? You would think that if this guy was sick and tired of people asking him the question, he wouldn't be stoking the fires like this. So that was, you know, an answer that caught a lot of people's attention, myself included. Now, I think if he really does have an interest in possibly coming back, I think it probably has more to do with him working at the Performance Center, and he's on the road as an agent now for a lot of those NXT Live events. I think it probably has a lot more to do with that than it does with money. You know, he's around it again. Maybe he's getting the itch. And look, if it was just about money, again, he would have come back years ago. Unless he's made some bad investments again, like he did when he had to become JBL's slave. I don't think it's just a, you know, a money thing. But anyway, he says it would have to be done the right way and just for one match rather than something that ran for longer. It could be possible, but people would have to accept that they would not be getting the showstopper, Mr. WrestleMania, and that I am 52 years old now. He admits the most likely scenario for a return would be in a tag team match with Triple H, possibly doing a DX reunion and getting a few crotch chops in, which, excuse me for a moment while I gag, what a waste that would be. What a waste that would be for Shawn Michaels to come back after 8 or 9 years, only for another lame DX reunion. I'd rather he stay retired if that's all he's going to do. Now, he did float names in the interview like AJ Styles, Daniel Bryan, Johnny Gargano, as guys that he would have loved to have gotten in there with in his prime one-on-one. If you ask me, is Shawn Michaels coming back? The answer is no. Shawn Michaels is not coming back. You know, it's interesting to read that and get excited about the possibilities and say, oh, you know, what would a match with him and so-and-so be like? It's fun. It could be fun to sort of fantasy book things like that. But I think that's, at the end of the day, I think that's all it is. I don't believe he's coming back. I think this is all pie in the sky. But again, it's fun to think about. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe in a year, we'll look back on this clip and on this video or podcast or, you know, wherever this ends up, and you could tell me how wrong I was. And it's, honestly, it's a scenario where I kind of hope I am wrong, because Styles and Bryan are two names I would love to see in there with Shawn Michaels, absolutely. But the name that I think would work best one-on-one is someone who Shawn said just last year would be his dream opponent in WWE. And it was not AJ Styles. That man is Samoa Joe. Shawn told ESPN at that time, I see his stuff at NXT. Obviously, Joe was still in NXT at the time. I see his stuff at NXT and I think to myself, man, I could have had a great deal of fun with you. Forget the sexual imagery there because that's just horrifying. I would love to see that match too. You know, Joe is more of a brawler. Shawn, I thought Shawn Michaels always worked well with brawlers and guys who were bigger than him most of the time. I mean, you know, you can only do so much if you're in there in 1995 with King Kong Bundy. I don't know that anybody could have gotten a good match out of King Kong Bundy in 1995. But I've seen Shawn Michaels in there with guys like Sid and Diesel and Mankind and guys that were not at all his style that he ended up having fantastic matches with. Well, maybe not fantastic with Sid, but I do think their Survivor Series 96 match at the Garden where Shawn lost was actually pretty good. So Joe kind of fits that mold a little bit more. He is bigger than Shawn. He is more of a brawler. Plus, I think the promos leading up to that match would be top-notch. Joe is the best talker maybe in the world when it comes to wrestling. He's the best talker in the company right now. Shawn can hold his own. Joe, I think, would be the perfect opponent for Shawn Michaels. As a one-off with the right opponent, he still looks like he's keeping in great shape. It would be great to see. But for him to come back just to do a tag team match, look, he could do what he wants, whatever makes the guy happy. He's earned that. If he wants to come back at 52 or 53 to point to his crotch and throw glow sticks, that's his call. But I would just as soon remember his last match as being something a little more serious than that. Leo Rush is coming to 205 Live. There was a vignette that aired during the show this past Tuesday. It showed him sitting at a table. He was very cocky and very arrogant. He called himself a living legend. He called himself a 23-year-old piece of gold. and that it would only be a matter of time before 205 Live felt the rush, and then the camera panned out and we saw stacks of cash sitting on the table in front of him. So, looks pretty promising. You know, he's fortunate that the blowback has seemingly blown over from the whole Twitter episode with Emma. After Emma was released, we don't need to rehash the whole thing. But he was definitely on people's shit list after that, and we didn't see too much of him, and I don't even think he was doing much in the way of live events up until, you know, more recently, in recent months he is. And he's, you know, basically bypassing NXT and going straight to the main roster, if you consider 205 Live to be the main roster, which I would. So, good for him. I don't know if they're going to put somebody with him. They've had somebody from Developmental with him, seconding him as a bodyguard, I think, at some of the house shows. It was one of the guys that popped up in the Greatest Royal Rumble, Babatunde, I forgot his name, but I don't know if they're going to put the two of them together as a pair. You know, I think that could work if you wanted to put, you know, Leo's not a big guy, and most of the guys on 205 Live are not big, but I think to have that sort of, you know, the juxtaposition of, let's say, Leo with a guy who's 6'8" or something would be kind of a cool sight, and he could continue to act cocky and arrogant and all that kind of stuff and throw his money around because he knows he's got somebody behind him who can kick your ass if you try to kick his. So that could work, but there was no sign of any sort of bodyguard in this vignette, so I have no idea if that's sort of the road they're going down. But let's talk a little bit about NXT this past week, because Shayna Baszler was in the ring opening the show. She was interrupted by Nikki Cross. That's the match they're setting up for TakeOver in Chicago, I guess next weekend already. Wow, yeah, next Saturday, I believe, is the TakeOver show. I completely forgot about that. I didn't realize it was approaching that quickly. So anyway, they had a little bit of a face-off, and Shayna was very much put off by the fact that Nikki is this crazy person, and, you know, Nikki stood her ground and went after her, and she even hit a huge cross body off the top rope onto Shayna, and Shayna retreated, so that's their setup to that match. We had TM61 taking on Mike Hughley and Robbie Grand. I cannot think of two more jobberish names. The jobberest of jobber teams here on NXT losing to TM61, which is showing more of a mean streak. I think it was Thorne who clobbered Grand in the back of the head with a forearm for the pin. And they cut a promo, did TM61 when the match was over. They mentioned that all the other teams in NXT would kneel at their feet and call them the Mighty, which is a play off the name they used before they came to WWE, which was the Mighty Don't Kneel. Now, they didn't call themselves the Mighty Don't Kneel, but the way they sort of phrased it here, it sounded like this could be a name change going forward, where instead of TM61, they're called the Mighty. I don't know. I mean, maybe I just misunderstood, but it sounded to me like that's their new name. Well, I guess we'll find out. It's too bad a new name doesn't bring new charisma, but they're doing the best they can with them. I think the heel turn was the right thing to do. I don't know. It feels like there's not a lot there. But then again, wait until this next segment, because in the very next segment, it was a pre-tape from earlier in the day showing Lars Sullivan at the Performance Center in one of the rings just beating the hell out of a bunch of different people. And the funniest part of this segment, if you look very closely in the background, I'm sure some people didn't pick up on this, but if you look in the background as Lars is killing these people and just throwing them around, you see a door open in the background, off in the distance, and through the door walking in is TM61. They see what's going on with Sullivan in the ring, they shake their heads, and they immediately turn back around and they leave. And that was more charisma than I've seen from them since they debuted. We had Roderick Strong against Danny Burch. Good little match here. I like Danny Burch. I'm happy for him. He just signed a contract finally, an actual formal contract. He's been on some of the independent shows I've been to here in Brooklyn, even as recently as, I think, probably earlier this year, late last year. He's been all over the place, and he's a really good worker. And him and Oney Lorcan both, they just have this sort of old school brawler vibe about them. That's why I like that team so much. So he went one-on-one with Strong. Like I said, they had a good match. We had Kyle O'Reilly and Adam Cole did run down to interfere. Roddy did get the win. Pete Dunne and Oney Lorcan did come out to make a save to try to get rid of the rest of the Undisputed Era. But in the end, it was the backbreaker from Roderick Strong after the distraction that allowed him to get the pin. After the match, Pete Dunne snuck into the ring, and Roddy did not realize that Pete Dunne was standing behind him, and he attacked Roddy. Adam Cole made the save. And so anyway, this, I guess this sets up, this sets up that six-man for the UK tapings that they're going to be doing, but that's actually Pete Dunne with Tyler Bate in Trent Seven, and not Oney Lorcan and Danny Burch. So I don't know when we're going to be getting this match, if they announced it already, if maybe it's going to be on TV next week. I'm not sure, but that certainly seems to be the direction they're going in. We had Cassius Ohno doing a photo shoot backstage when EC3 interrupts him. He starts, as he says, joshing him. And Ohno called him an arrogant blowhard and then threw down the gauntlet. EC3 accepted his challenge for a match. I don't know when. They didn't specify a date. EC3 walked off. Cassius Ohno then apologized. He apologized to the, I guess, the photographer off camera for the interruption and just kept posing. So, what a gentleman. We had an awesome video package hyping up the match between Ricochet and Velveteen Dream at TakeOver. This is the match that I am most looking forward to, Money in the Bank weekend, between Money in the Bank and TakeOver. This is it. It was the same thing with Dream and Aleister Black in Houston last year for that War Games. As much as I was looking forward to the War Games match, that match between Aleister Black and Velveteen Dream was, for me, it turned out to be the highlight of the weekend. I thought the best match, even better than War Games. I enjoyed it more, but here we are again. Velveteen Dream happens to be in a match that I am genuinely stoked for going into the show. And Dream is one of the few, for me, must-see acts right now in WWE. Kairi Sane won the rubber match in her series of matches with Lacey Evans, pinning her after the insane elbow drop off the top rope. Evans impressed me here in this match. She missed a moonsault, but it was one of those old Mark Merrow moonsaults. And actually, we've seen Kevin Owens do this in WWE as well, where she's on the middle rope on the inside, facing her opponent. She does this twisting jump up onto the top rope, balances herself, and then hits a moonsault. So that was cool. That's a hard move to pull off. Those ropes can be slippery, especially, you know, maybe not here, but if you've had a long match or other people have been wrestling before you, there's sweat, God knows what else, all over those ropes. I'd be terrified to even try something like that. So that was cool to see. And we got a Tommaso Ciampa, Johnny Gargano brawl to end the show, heading into their street fight to take over Chicago. Ciampa was trashing Gargano on the mic. Gargano came out, and security guards are trying to hold him back. He breaks free, and a brawl breaks out. He's going after Ciampa. And so security's trying to break these two guys up, right? And so Gargano's punching out security guards. He's lost it. He's completely lost it. And Ciampa attacks him from behind, lays him out. He puts Gargano in his own hold. He puts him in the Gargano escape and leaves him laying, goes to leave. They even put the copyright up on the screen, right? Hey, whenever you see Ciampa, remember, when the copyright goes up, that don't mean the show is over. And in this case, instead of doing what every other WWE star does, which is when they get beaten up, they're laying in the ring, they make a mean face, and they look at their opponent. Instead of getting the fuck out of the ring and chasing them down and beating the hell out of them, he slid out of the ring. He's like, I'm not finished with you. He gets out of the ring, and he hunts down Ciampa, and he ends up putting Ciampa in the Gargano escape. On stage, Ciampa had his head busted open. I think it was when Gargano rammed him into the giant Tron and the LED boards. And so I think it was the top of Ciampa's head that got busted open. He's bleeding. And so that was a hell of a way for them to go off the air. It's not often we see blood here on NXT television. And not often, like I said, that the babyface actually gets out of the ring instead of just making a mean face. And goes after the heel and, you know, puts the boots to them and lays them out. And that's what Gargano did as they went off the air. So this was good stuff. I am looking forward to their match at TakeOver. Don't get me wrong. I think it's going to be great. But I still am most looking forward to Ricochet and Velveteen Dream. Let's do some mailbag questions. If you have questions, you can email them to me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Start with Shady from Burbank, California. With Money in the Bank coming up, I had a thought about what if Money in the Bank had been around back in the 80s and 90s. Who do you think would have made for a good Mr. Money in the Bank, and what cash-ins would you have booked? Ted DiBiase would have been great with IRS carrying his briefcase, or perhaps DiBiase cashes in after Andre beats Hogan for the championship on the Hebner Twins controversy, but we see Andre lay down because Ted had already paid him, and then DiBiase becomes the champion. Well, that would have been better than Andre just handing over the tag team title. And that's what he called it, by the way, not me. He called it the tag team title. Oh, Andre. But the problem with that, though, is then they would not have had a reason to vacate the championship and have that tournament at WrestleMania and crown, you know, Macho Man as the new champion and all that. So that probably wouldn't have worked. I'll be honest with you, though. I'm going to answer your question, but I'm actually glad we did not have the Money in the Bank gimmick back in the 80s. There were far fewer title defenses on TV back then anyway, and the championships just generally meant more and just felt more valuable than they do now. I think the whole Money in the Bank concept, it can be fun. There could be really fun cash-ins and all that, but I just feel like it's sort of, I don't know, almost like bastardized the whole championship thing. I don't know. It's one of those ideas that I think it's a fun idea, but it can get played out. And, you know, now they have, you know, there was a point where they had multiple Money in the Bank matches for the men, let alone, you know, one for the men and one for the women makes sense at least. So I'm happy we didn't have Money in the Bank in the 80s and 90s. Having said that, the first person I thought of when I saw this question was not Ted DiBiase. It was Owen Hart. Owen Hart in 1994 would have been the perfect choice for the Money in the Bank briefcase. He beats Bret Hart, right? He beats Big Brother Bret at WrestleMania 10. Bret comes back later in the night, beats Yokozuna, wins the championship. It's right, exactly what happened. I would do exactly what happened. And let's say if King of the Ring in June comes along, instead of King of the Ring, it's Money in the Bank. Or maybe at King of the Ring, there's a Money in the Bank match. And instead of winning the crown, which really wouldn't make sense to have a tournament and a Money in the Bank match, but just work with me here. Let's say Money in the Bank happened in June. Instead of Owen becoming king, let's say he wins the briefcase instead. Now, Bret that night on that King of the Ring show had a title match with Diesel. Bret gets laid out, which I think is exactly what happened when the match was over, right? He got powerbombed, he got laid out. But let's say Owen comes out. Owen comes back out at that point. He cashes in on his brother to win the WWF title. That would have been something that the Owen Hart character at that time totally would have done. Yeah, you had Owen with carrying around slammies and all kinds of stuff, and I'm the King of Hearts. And like, that is absolutely something that Owen Hart character would have done back in 94. And cashing in on his brother to win the championship, that would have worked. And then he could just drop it back to Bret in the cage match at SummerSlam. I wouldn't change anything about the match, the cage match at SummerSlam, but maybe Owen goes in as champion, Bret gets the belt back. I mean, you could work that, you know, any number of ways. But again, when you mentioned, hey, if Money in the Bank was around in the 80s and 90s, who would be a good fit for it? The first thing I thought of, Owen Hart, 1994. Jarrell from Far Rockaway, Queens. I just read an article saying that AAA is going to run a show at Madison Square Garden and that WWE is not happy about it. I've said for a long time that since Vince does all of his shows at the Barclays Center and no longer wants to host a WrestleMania at MSG, which I understand due to arena size, that MSG should let other promotions like Impact, Lucha Underground, etc. have shows there. I always felt it was messed up that Vince would try to keep other promotions out of his house because he doesn't even use it anymore. When WWE did the Greatest Royal Rumble and left the women out, I thought they should have given the women their own pay-per-view at Madison Square Garden to make up for it. What are your thoughts? Well, I think that would have been a terrible idea. You need time to promote something like that. And I think to ask, you know, the people to buy enough tickets to where you can sell out or get close to a sellout at, you know, Madison Square Garden just for an all-women's pay-per-view, is asking a bit much. My suggestion was, you know, with enough foresight, I don't know why they couldn't have had a house show tour and done a bunch of shows, not even pay-per-views, but just had a bunch of shows just with the women on it back here in the States. That, I think, would have made more sense. And eventually, I do think that the women will have their own special. I mean, they're going to have it in August, right? Because they're bringing back the Mae Young Classic. But I mean, as far as like a pay-per-view, I do think at some point that will happen. To do that at Madison Square Garden back in April would have been insane. But, you know, it's a weird thing because I, you know, every time you ask, why don't they run the garden? Why don't they run the garden? You get the same answer. Whether it's union costs, production costs, it just costs more money to run the garden than it does, especially for live television, than it does any other venue. And I don't know if that has to do with the Dolans. The Dolans are morons. They own the garden and the Knicks and all that, and they've turned, God, have they turned that franchise to shit. So I don't doubt that whatever the Dolans touch probably turns to garbage. That may have a little something to do with it, but it comes down to cost. And now you have this newer building in Brooklyn, very close by, where they can run it. They have apparently a great relationship with Barclays. Last few years, SummerSlam, right? They run 3-4 straight nights in that building. And I'm sure it doesn't cost nearly as much. Just as easy to get to by train, you know, by public transportation. If you live in New York, I mean, parking over there is no fun. But parking isn't fun at MSG either. Who goes to Madison Square Garden and parks? If you do, why? Seriously, there's no reason to, unless you want to pay, you know, $50 just to park your car. Now, this AAA thing, I read that news too, and I don't know that that's been confirmed, although the belief is that maybe there were conversations and negotiations going on, and it's not for the theater, the little theater, 3,000-4,000 seat theater they have at the Garden. This would be for MSG proper. It's not official, though. What's interesting about it is that, you know, WWE has had, I don't know if it's still like part of their written contract and agreement that they have with the Garden, but they have a clause in there basically that keeps other promotions from running, or at least gives WWE the right to have a say in whether or not other wrestling promotions run there. That's been the belief also for a number of years. They effectively have this exclusivity over the Garden. So I don't know that AAA is going to be able to run the Garden, but there's certainly conversations ongoing, and MSG is sort of, I don't know if they're trying to stick it to WWE, but they can't be happy about the fact that they got passed over for all those WrestleMania weekend events, Hall of Fame and, you know, Raw and everything else next year. They're probably not too happy. I don't know the nature of the contract and the agreement that they had or have, if they still do. I just don't know. And if people say they know, then they don't. Only the people who, you know, probably made the deal even know what the deal says. I think it would be cool to let other promotions run. Your idea that they would just let Impact run the Garden, I had to pick myself up off the floor when you said that. That was maybe the funniest thing I've read all week. Like, as though Impact could just run the Garden, you know? It's like, you know, God bless Impact. I hope they're doing well, but they ain't running Madison Square Garden. Nor could they afford to run Madison Square Garden. So it'll be interesting to see how that resolves itself, because I don't think they can. I don't think AAA can run the Garden. But apparently there are conversations going on, and we'll see what happens. Now, I don't think it's a coincidence that this week, after this news comes out, there was a big graphic on the marquee outside Madison Square Garden that had a picture of The Undertaker promoting that The Undertaker has been added to the WWE Madison Square Garden house show lineup for their show coming up on July 7th. And they're billing it as the first time in 8 years that Undertaker has wrestled at the Garden. Now, why else do you think Undertaker would all of a sudden be added to the lineup for the MSG show on July 7th? So that's WWE's way, I guess, of throwing the Garden a bone. But I think that bone's going to have to be a lot bigger if they're going to want to make them happy. A lot of you guys wanted to know my thoughts on the new Halloween trailer that dropped on Friday, and I'm more than happy to talk about that here for a few minutes. Danny McBride, Kenny Powers, of Eastbound and Down fame, he was a writer on the new movie. He's not directing it, but this is, you know, in a lot of ways, this is his movie. He had a hand in writing the screenplay. John Carpenter, who was the mastermind behind the original Halloween, him and Deborah Hill back in 1978. He's back. He is scoring the film. Now, that beat, that sort of piano beat, the eerie piano beat music you remember from the original Halloween, that was Carpenter. You know, and he's told that story. I think his father taught him how to, like, compose. And it's a very simple beat, but it's like the eeriest song in the world. So they're bringing him back to score the new film. And that's apparent right away. If you watch the trailer, it dropped on Friday. Listen to the music. It's like the same music from the original, which is really cool. You know, I want it to be or sound like, if it isn't actually the music from the original. So as far as the movie itself, it was about... Was it two minutes and 45 seconds, this trailer? I always worry that in these trailers, they give away too much. Hopefully, they didn't give away all the good scenes in the trailer. I think, actually, it was probably a mistake to include that last scene, the closet scene. And if you watch it, you'll know what I'm talking about. That would have been a great, you know, like a great jump scare going to the theater to see the movie. But even that, the idea of like a jump scare, there's obviously a lot of blood and probably gore in this movie. And... You know, I will say one of the things I loved and one of the great things about the original Halloween, it is not a gory movie. It was an independently made film. It was an independent movie that ended up making like $50 million. And obviously it spawned all of these additional sequels and prequels and reboots. But the original movie in 1978 was not a bloody film. It was not a gory film. I don't know that there was any blood. Now that I think about it, there may not have been. Or if there was, very little, maybe in like one scene. There was basically no blood, let alone gore and guts, in the original Halloween. It was all based on fear. It was fear of the unknown. We never found out why Michael Myers did what he did. We never found out why Michael Myers, as a six-year-old, stabbed his sister to death, let alone why he was going after Laurie Strode. And it wasn't until later on that they introduced in the sequel, which Carpenter didn't even want to do, it wasn't until then that he introduced this idea that, you know, Michael was Laurie's sister. That was not in the original movie. And in fact, that's not in this movie either. They poked fun at that in the trailer. They have Jamie Lee Curtis is back, which is why people, I think, are so excited about this. And obviously, she's a lot older now. She's a grandmother. Her daughter is played, whoever her daughter is played by, there's a scene where she's walking home from school with her friends. And they're like, hey, Michael Myers, isn't he related to your mom? And she's like, no, that was like an urban legend. So they kind of poked fun at it. that part of the Kanan came in the sequel. But the original was based on this idea of fear of the unknown. Where, like I said, we don't know why Michael did what he did. They call him the Shape. You don't see too much of him in the movie either. You don't see his face until the very end. And what's interesting about that is when he's unmasked late in the first movie... You don't know what to expect, right? You're expecting, oh, this guy's going to be ugly. He's going to have, like, boils all over his face or be hideously disfigured. He's not. He's just a regular person. Now, there's something wrong with the eye. I remember that. Like, they did something with the makeup where it made it look like maybe his eye was kind of, or eyelid was disfigured. But for the most part, he looked like a normal person, which is also kind of unnerving, if you think about it, right? He's not some mutant. He's not some weird creature. He's a regular human being. And so they don't give away too much in that first movie. Now, all of these horror movies and the slasher movies, you see everything. And you see it from the opening scene. And the killer, you get to see what they look like. You get to see their face a lot, probably more than you should. But you get all the different jump scares and you get all the, you know, blood and guts and gore. And look, I like the original Saw movie. I like that movie. I thought it was a good movie. I thought the big twist at the end is just one of the great twists that I didn't see coming. And then every other subsequent Saw movie, it's just, they call it torture porn, which is really what it is. And it was just them trying to come up with creative ways that they could kill people and try to spill as much blood as possible. I don't know. You know, the original Halloween movie, I liked it just the way it was. I think it's harder to make a horror movie like that now because people expect all that other stuff. We'll see how much of that is in the new movie. I think that's something that this movie will probably have a lot of. We saw some of it in the trailer, and whatever. I mean, that's fine. That's just, look, it's just the way horror films are now, I guess. But for the most part, I liked what I saw in that trailer. It really evoked, you know, memories and feelings of the original. It won't have that same older sort of gritty 1978 look. I mean, it's 2018 for crying out loud. So I get that. But I think they're trying to stay as true as possible to that original. This is a direct sequel. So what they're doing here is they are ignoring every single movie that came after the original, including Part 2, which was supposed to pick up from that very night. Never happened. Part 3 didn't have anything to do with Michael Myers anyway. And I love that movie, by the way. If you've sort of cast Part 3 aside, oh, it's not Michael, it's not a real Halloween movie. Do yourself a favor and watch Season of the Witch. It's actually really good as its own sort of standalone horror film. But yeah, they're ignoring everything. Part 4, Part 5, which had Danielle Harris in there, who was very upset and very bummed that she was not invited to be back as part of this new Halloween movie. And I am too, to be honest with you. I think she should have been in this movie as Jamie Lee Curtis's sister. Or, I'm sorry, not her sister, my God. Her much younger sister. No, her daughter. I think it would have been cool because she was a big part of those later Halloween films. But they didn't bring her back for whatever reason. But yeah, so you got to ignore every single Michael Myers film that came after the original because that's the approach they took with this movie. I know it can be confusing, but I'm excited. I really am. I'm very excited to see this movie. It comes out October, it was the 19th. It comes out right before Halloween this year. I thought the trailer was pretty sick. And the mask is on point. The Shatner mask. It's obviously withered and older and beat up. But some of the masks that they've used for Michael in these other movies have not been good, to say the least. So even right down to the mask, I think that they've done a good job with this. I know it's only a trailer, it's hard to tell, but we'll see what kind of a horror writer Danny McBride is when this movie comes out. But I thought the trailer was great. I can't wait to see it. Kevin from Baltimore, I've been watching some Attitude Era Raws recently, and I think there are at least two different periods that fall within the Attitude Era category. 1997 feels grungy and unpredictable, with the new generation stars being phased out as Stone Cold began his incredible run. 1999 feels even, or still feels, grungier than the highly polished Ruthless Aggression era. And Rock really shines as a main eventer. Buy or sell on WWE programming from 1997 or 1999? Now, I can tell you, having gone back and watched some of those shows from 99 and the big pops that Stone Cold would get, it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun to look out into the crowd and see a sea of signs and see everybody actually reacting and cheering for the people they're supposed to cheer for and just having a great time, right? And being entertained for the most part and being engaged. Not everything, though, in 99 was all a bed of roses. There was a lot of crap in 1999 on those shows and a lot of the undercard stuff. A lot of it is actually really brutal to go back and watch. It does not hold up well. The stuff with Stone Cold and all that does, Austin McMahon, I mean, you can't top that. Rock came into his own as a big star. I personally never really liked Ministry Undertaker, but I know a lot of you did. So there was a lot of good and a lot of bad in 99, but business was booming. So people look back, you know, with the rose-colored glasses, everything was great in 99, which is not true. 97 does not get enough love. 97 had some bad stuff. It wasn't a perfect year, but 97, I'm going to buy on 97. I'm going to sell on 99. 97 set the stage for the Attitude Era. Late 96, early 97 is what set the stage and was, in my opinion, the true beginning of the Attitude Era. It wasn't the first time Austin stunned McMahon or the Montreal Screwjob. No, absolutely not. The Attitude Era, the seeds were planted long before Vince McMahon screwed Bret Hart. And it goes back, I would say at the latest, it goes back to the night on Raw before WrestleMania, where Bret snapped after he lost the cage match to Sid. He shoved Vince on his ass, and he just went on this profanity-laced tirade. This was 6 days before WrestleMania. They were trying to sell the show. It was something we had never seen before, and it was also the birth of the seven-second delay. Thanks, Bret. But I wouldn't go any later than that. You know, that you could say that was the start of the Attitude Era, but I would go back even further. I mean, the end of 96, everybody just felt pissed off at each other. Shawn Michaels had this attitude about him, like he was just pissed at the world. Bret Hart thought everybody was out to screw him. You had Sid, you had Undertaker, you had Stone Cold, I guess Vader, if you want to throw him in there. And the one common goal was they all wanted to be champion. They all wanted to have that WWF title. But everybody was just constantly in a state of being pissed off at each other. it was really, it was an attitude. There was an attitude about the product, and they were starting to push the envelope more with Goldust and some of these other characters. So when I go back now and I watch some of that stuff from 97, watching Brett and Sean, knowing how real the hatred really was between them and trading barbs back and forth, Brett sitting in the wheelchair with his knee up, calling, you know, cutting promos on Shawn Michaels, calling him boy toy, you pierce your navel, you're pathetic, you know, all this other stuff was always fun. The Hart Foundation against, the Americans, U.S. versus Canada, that was a lot of fun. The rise of Stone Cold as this big baby face. Unfortunately, he got hurt at SummerSlam, but even after he got hurt, you know, they found a role for him on the show. He was stunning everybody. The cops had to restrain him, and there was a lot going on. We had the Shawn Michaels Undertaker feud for the first time. We had the very first Hell in a Cell, of course, Montreal. We all know what happened there. So for all of the bad stuff that there was in 97, like the gang warfare stuff, right? Now, on its own, The Nation, I guess, was kind of a cool faction. I like the Hart Foundation. This gang warfare bullshit, I thought was the most boring stuff in the world. You had the Barriquas, and you had the Skinheads, and you had all these different groups. You had the Job Squad and the Truth Commission. It's like, oh my, not the Job Squad, but you had the Truth Commission, Hart Foundation, DOA, Barriquas, Truth Commission. I feel like I'm missing another one. There were so many groups and gangs, and everybody is just fighting it, but it's these boring groups like the Barriquas and DOA. Who cares? Let them kill each other. I don't care. So, yeah, I wasn't a big fan of that, but boy, 97, it was like the company was changing right before your eyes. It really was like this tipping point for the company that just led very nicely into what everybody calls the Attitude Era. But hey, that Attitude Era started a lot earlier than I think people say. And you can trace it all the way back to the end of 96. 97 was a fun year. 97 was a fun year. 99 was fun, but I got to buy on 97. We'll do one more here, another non-wrestling question. Devin from New Jersey, you said before that The Sopranos is one of your favorite shows of all time. Having just finished watching the whole show, I was wondering your thoughts on the final scene. Did you like it? Why do you think they decided to end the show this way? And do you think Don Tony died? Tony. Do you think Tony died in the final scene? Wow, there's a lot to unpack there. Yeah, I like The Sopranos a lot. I didn't come into it until much later on, but it's one of the best shows ever made. I guess there are some people who don't like the Italian stereotypes on the show, but I think as a television show, as like a mini movie of sorts, I used to watch those episodes of The Sopranos, and just, I was filled with such dread. I guess if you watch any of these mob movies, you would be, because you don't know when the next person's getting whacked and what's going to happen next. A lot of these guys, they have a short fuse too, right? So the slightest thing, you're just worried, like, okay, what's coming around the corner here? So I always used to watch that show just with dread, but it was a really good show. And I remember watching the final scene, like a lot of people did, and when the screen went black, and there's spoilers here, sorry. When the screen went black, when Tony is sitting in the diner and the screen goes black, after 10 seconds, it felt like forever, I thought the power went out or something. I'm sure a lot of people thought the same thing. Then the credits come on, and then you realize, oh no, like, that can't be it. And my initial reaction was I was pissed off. Like, I didn't like that ending at all. And I'll be honest with you, like, even looking back on it now, I could see, like, David Chase, he's trying to be cute. He wants people to figure out on their own. You come up with what you think happened to Tony, right? I thought it's this great discussion point where it's like one of those choose-your-own-ending adventure books that you read as a kid. As a kid, that's fine. As an adult, it just sort of gets on my nerves. It's like, well, no, you're the storyteller here. Why can't you finish the story? I feel like that's what WWE has done for years now. They've just taken the choose-your-own-ending approach. They don't have to because they're lazy. So I wasn't a big fan of that ending at all. I've grown to, I guess, appreciate it more, you know, as opposed to just having a boring ending where they're all sitting under the sun or something, looking at the stars, or just having somebody come up and just bust a cap right in Tony's skull, which would have been quite the way to go off the air. So I've warmed up to it. I'm still not a big fan of it. As far as do I think Tony died? Yes, I do. And the answer is right there in that very season, in one of the earlier episodes. He and Bobby Bacala are sitting on the boat, right, in the pond or wherever the hell they are. And they're having a conversation about what, I wonder what it's like when it happens. Basically, when you get whacked, when you get killed. I wonder if you even, like, hear it, like, hear the shot, right? Is that what he said, I think? And they had this conversation. In fact, in a later episode, there was even a very quick flashback after Bobby is killed, I think, when Tony is holed up somewhere. They even flash back to that scene. Well, now you have the show going off the air in a blackout scene. And people wondering, you know, did that guy in the diner shoot him? What happened? Well, if we go by the logic of that scene, then yes, he was shot and killed. So it's pretty obvious to me that Tony Soprano was killed at the end of that episode. But again, everyone's very, like, passionate. They have their point of view about what they think happened on that last episode. And I think David Chase intentionally left things open to possibly do a movie, which now he can't do because James Gandolfini is dead. And I do think that were he not dead, especially you see the way these TV reboots and everyone's all about reboots and, you know, old shows coming back and they're doing well. And I think at some point we would have gotten some kind of a Sopranos movie. I guess now they're working on a Sopranos movie. It's a prequel, which sounds kind of interesting. But no, I mean, do I think Tony, the character, was killed in that scene? Yeah, I do. And I think it was foreshadowed right there earlier that season. If you have questions for the mailbag, wrestling or otherwise, you can send them in thesolemonster@gmail.com. When you do include your name and where you are from, it does improve your chances of having your question read here on the show. It's very helpful to me, so please include that. Follow me on Twitter, @solemonster. A lot of big shows coming up, including TakeOver, Money in the Bank. So if you want to follow my rantings along on Twitter, that is the place to go for that. I will be at the Garden on Thursday. Maybe, hey, I don't know if anybody listening right now is going. I hope so. It should be a great show. Hall & Oates, Thursday night, Madison Square Garden. Out of Touch, Vince McMahon's favorite song. Maneater, right? Adult Education. I think Adult Education may have actually supplanted Out of Touch as my my all-time favorite song. It's neck and neck. Got Private Eyes, Say It Isn't So, right? Which is what I actually said out loud when I saw that tweet from WWE about the Roman Reigns Jinder Mahal match taking place tomorrow night. Saying, Say It Isn't So. Anyway, that's on Thursday. Busy weekend next weekend. And for me, there may be an early show. I'm not sure exactly yet what's going on. I may have to record a day early. I have some place to be on Sunday. I'm going to do a podcast. I don't know when it's going up. That's TBD. But we'll have Money in the Bank predictions next weekend. We have the return of Lucha Underground Reviews to the Sound Off. Show is back on Wednesday. Very excited for that as well. A lot to be excited about. Maybe not on Monday nights, but a lot to be excited about. So until next time, be well, stay safe. Thank you all for your support through 550 episodes of this podcast. Here's to 550 more. And I will see you guys back here for more Sound Off next weekend. Until then, take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solemonster sounds off.
Mundo goes to leave, and Taya says, "Wait, aren't you going to put any pants on?" He just goes, "No time for pants," and he walks off. That also happens to be Randy Orton's philosophy in life. My philosophy, too. See, you don't know if I'm wearing pants right now or not, do you? You can't see. I could be wearing nothing right now, for all you know. No time for pants.
Solemonster sounds off. Since 2007, the Solemonster sounds off. Available at thesolemonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solemonster sound off.